Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Newbury Court, a full-service retirement community in Concord, Massachusetts. Newbury Court is committed to creating active, independent lifestyles for persons 62 and over. More at newburycourt.org.
And the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Be revolutionary. UMass is the Commonwealth's flagship public research university and committed to the relentless pursuit of progress. Learn more at umass.edu.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, former coal lobbyist Andrew Wheeler, the acting administrator of the EPA, and Trump nominee to lead the agency, has been busy rolling back key environmental regulations. We'll talk to Gina McCarthy, who worked hard to put protections in place when she ran the EPA in the Obama era. We'll ask her about this, a recent convergence of reports on climate change that all tell a doomsday scenario, and a landmark agreement in Massachusetts to cut transportation emissions. From there, we open the lines and ask you where your holiday stress levels are. Ours are high. Then at noon, national security expert Juliet Kayyem is here, and that means it's Mueller time.
Okay. From there, we get a diplomat's take on the latest news in France. Boston's consul general joins us for his take on the yellow vest protests, the recent UN climate talks, and more. Then WGBH executive arts editor Jared Bowen is here with the latest rundown of arts and culture events in and around town. All that coming up. Eastern Browdy, I am Marjorie Yeagan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
Hello, Marjorie. So according to a U.S. government report on climate change, which was released, I think it was last month, one of the central conclusions is that the U.S. economy could shrink by 10% if steps aren't taken to rein in global warming, a finding that prompted this response from President Trump when he was confronted by reporters.
I don't believe it. No, I don't believe it. And here's the other thing. You're going to have China and Japan and all of Asia and all of these other countries, you know, addresses our country. Right now, we're at the cleanest we've ever been, and that's very important to me. But if we're clean, but every other place on Earth is dirty, that's not so good. So I want clean air. I want clean water. Very important.
I'll tell you, nothing says clean air like pitching fossil fuels at the climate talks, or clean water like pushing to roll back federal water protections. Joining us for her take on this, and hopefully to allay Marjorie's fears and other environmental headlines, Gina McCarthy. She was the EPA administrator during the Obama administration. She now runs the Center for Climate, Health, and the Global Environment at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Gina McCarthy, great to see you as always.
Jim, it's great to be here. Nice to be here with you, Marjorie.
Great to talk to you, too, because I'm obsessed with what you're obsessed with, which is climate change.
Who says I'm obsessed?
Well, I'm obsessed. So we just had this at COP24, this global climate summit in Poland. There was a famed picture of the president, you know, of the COP24 dancing on the table. I'm confused. How pleased should we be from the results of this summit?
Well, I think we should be displeased in the fact that the U.S. wasn't particularly helpful in this summit.
Yeah.
In fact, they aligned with a couple of other countries to continue to question the science, as you heard from President Trump. And the one thing I want to make very clear is climate science isn't a belief system. It's not a religion. It's fact and science that just needs to be factored in to decisions we make. And the leadership that we need to provide at the international level is pretty critical. So all in all, Paris resulted in steps forward. You know, it designed and helped to define the process moving forward, doing two things that are important. One is, what are the rules of the road? What should we expect every country to do to calculate their emissions and to plan for reductions? And it established a process over the next year to really sort of escalate and bring up front the challenge that we're seeing in science today, which is that the climate is changing more than we ever anticipated. We need to escalate and amplify the commitments that each country is making. And we can't do that unless you have rules of the road to understand what they are and in a process which they designed to really get to the heart of where we are now and where we need to go.
Yeah, but Gina McCarthy, my understanding is even if the U.S. was not the outlier, as it continues to be, or even when it's an inlier, if that's a word, it works to mute the statements, the resolutions, the action.
Yeah.
Even if everybody was in accord, all 200 countries or whatever it is, most experts, like Bill McKibben is with us pretty regularly, say that even if we achieve all the goals that we've agreed upon, it's too little and it's too late. Is that an unfairly pessimistic analysis?
No, and I don't think that Bill is incorrect. At least I hate to tell him he's incorrect because he gets upset about it. I think he's right. I mean, that's what the science is telling us now. The science is telling us that 2 degrees is not what we shoot for. It has to be 1.5. It's telling us that the Arctic ice is melting at an alarming rate that nobody anticipated. So the results we worried about happening later are beginning to happen now. So we do have to escalate ambition. But that was very clearly stated in the discussions in Poland.
That we do need to escalate
ambition. We do need to escalate. Absolutely. And the challenge that we face is how do we ramp that up in a way that really recognizes the need for immediate action, not long-term discussions. And with the U.S. not at the table, a lot of the sort of the innovation and the energy behind these discussions wanes, and we have to get back there.
Well, I want to talk about the politics of this in a couple of minutes, but a couple of things I wondered about from your perspective as an expert in this. You hear more and more people talking about nuclear power that we used to think was, you know, the worst horror imaginable. What should the role of nuclear be going forward?
Well, I think that what you see right now is a concern that a lot of the existing plants are going out because they have become non-competitive and they don't want to go through the permitting process to stick around. So I think the challenge with nuclear is really to define the next generation of nuclear that won't raise the same fears that were raised when you and I were growing up.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a large hurdle for the nuclear industry to be part of it, but it's understandable why those discussions should continue, because nuclear power clearly is carbon free.
Right.
And if you can make it safe and affordable, then it's fine. Right now, that the affordability is the key barrier. And there still is concern with generating waste and concerns with nuclear. You know, people just have an aversion to the word, you know, radionuclear.
Yeah, radioactivity makes people nervous.
It really does. Yeah. And I've been in the siting world before. People don't like to live near these things.
So you
have real barriers.
Did you ever have a discussion with President Obama when you were doing your job there about nuclear energy?
Actually, not specifically. I talked to Ernie Moniz a lot about it.
Another local guy from Fall River, Marjorie's hometown, we should say.
And he now lives right up the street from me.
Is that so?
Yeah,
oh, that's great.
Just a little bit closer to here than I do. So we actually do see one another, and he's big on this issue, and I think rightly we have to look at all options moving forward. But I just don't see the kind of nuclear that we're producing and building today being acceptable and achievable in the short term.
What do you think of that 15-year-old kid from Sweden, Greta Thunberg?
Tell people what she said.
Is a kid who did a three-week sit-in at the Swedish parliament, 15 years old. Her name is Greta Thunberg, and she gives a speech in Poland. We played some sound from it yesterday. It was so moving and so grown up, and also called out. You know the great line from Emma Gonzalez from Parkland, where she said, "I called BS."
Yeah,
this woman without science, 15-year-old woman, essentially called BS on all of these leaders for not being, as she said, mature enough to make the kind of tough decisions that I'm sure she thought. You know, the thing.
Well, let's divert into the politics of this for a second, then, because most people, and you look at polls, more and more Americans are concerned about climate change, but they're not that concerned. And when you see the president doing things like attacking, you know, wetlands regulations and doing things to undermine clean air and clean water, I just find it crazy and bizarre, but people don't seem that upset. So do we need to depend on the 15-year-olds and the 20-year-olds?
The attorneys general who are suing over all these things.
But it is amazing to me that what you're reading now is we're talking about possibly making the Earth unlivable. So our children and their children and their grandchildren.
Marjorie, sometimes when an issue is so big and so dramatic, and people don't believe that they have the power individually to fix it, or we don't present them with solutions to fix it, they deny.
Yeah.
And we have been doing that for a long time, thinking that if we terrify people, they'll get their heads out of the sand. And instead, they put their heads in and leave the rest of us sticking out. You know, this is what's happened. And so you really have to make it personal. You have to make it about their community. You have to make it about their city, their state, what it means for them individually, what it means for their kids. Everybody has a Greta in their life. Yeah. What's the name of yours?
Yeah.
Who are you going to relate to? Who are you going to be motivated by? It is not about the health of the planet. It is about the health of Greta. It is about the health of my grandson, Dax. That's why I sit here, not because it's the health of the planet. And I think there are solutions. And unfortunately, because we've spent so much time talking about the drama of the problem, we have not spent enough time broadening the uptake of solutions that are available to everybody. And I don't want anyone listening to this radio show that think that President Trump is dictating the behavior of the people in the United States related to climate change. Because if you look at it, communities care, cities are acting, states are acting. And as we know in New England, unless people at the grassroots level speak up, unless children like that remind us of our moral responsibility and start demanding political leadership that will lead on this, we will fail. But that is not what's happening in the United States.
By the way, I don't know if you, either of you guys saw that there was some British firm that I think paid 25,000 euro or something to purchase the naming rights to this recently discovered blind worm-like amphibian. Did you read about this?
Yes.
And you know what the name? What, you know what they named it for? $25,000. Dermophis Donald Trumpi, saying that essentially that's what he does too. In any case, sorry to offend Trump fans out there. You know, and a lot of people don't know
that. And I bet the range of that is extending into the Northeast as a result of climate change.
I gave the formal name of the thing that you're doing at the running at the T.H. Chan School of Public Health, but the short thing is sea change, right? As in climate change. And from what I understand, what you're doing is exactly what you just described to Marjorie, is while we all love the polar bears, and I really don't want angry letters, you know, saying we all care about the polar bears, but you're trying to make it much more immediate in everybody's life. So it's not some far off abstract notion.
Yeah.
But I mean, so one, how do you do that? And two, you said there are solutions, even if our federal government for the time being has checked out. What are the non-laugh test, you know, failing the laugh test things that people can be doing?
Well, one is that you know, one of the things I'm doing is searching throughout the school for information that has to be made available and accessible to people, because scientists are not the best communicators. Mm-hmm. And so you have to look at what the challenges are and understand them and communicate it effectively, and that's part of what we're doing. The other part is recognizing that we do have solutions. It's not just about your light bulbs need to be changed. I mean, that's not going to be the planet's solution. So you've really got to begin to act, as Massachusetts has in many ways, looking community by community at what you do. How do you expand the breadth of renewable energy that's available to everybody? How do you develop the finance processes to do that? What we've learned is that when you invest in clean energy and you incent it, it gets cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. And right now, it's to the point where if it's not available to you, you should be screaming because you're losing money because people are denying it available to you, because it's cheapest in terms of its availability. You have to look at the transportation sector. What we saw in Massachusetts was an unveiling of a transportation plan that set goals for sort of getting internal combustion engines off the road by 2040, really improving the transportation system, looking at congestion pricing. You saw nine states get together.
The thing announced yesterday about transportation emissions, I don't know enough. Is that a big deal?
It's a big deal. It's a big deal because it's the same states that got together when I was working for the Northeast in Massachusetts and then in Connecticut when we did the regional greenhouse gas initiative, which was the first cap and trade program in the United States. And essentially what it did, it put a dollar price on fossil fuel generation or carbon emissions for utilities. And every time they emitted carbon emissions, we made some money and we invested it in energy efficiency, renewable energy, that kind of stuff. And it resulted in very little, if any, increase in energy price. And it reduced our carbon emissions by 40% since 2005. This is the same kind of thing. This is a cap and invest. It's you cap the fossil fuel that's being used in our transportation sector in these states, and you reinvest it in things like electric car infrastructure. Mm-hmm. You know, things that will actually make this transition happen and make it cheaper and cheaper. So these are not out of the park things that we cannot do. These are the things that are being denied by climate deniers. These are the things that we're being told that too expensive and too out there, when in fact they are the things that will make us sustainable, make our energy infrastructure cheaper and better for all of us a health perspective, for sure.
We're talking to Jean McCarthy. She was the EPA administrator under Barack Obama. You just mentioned clean energy being cheaper. What are you talking about? Are you talking about our home heating energy, or be specific?
I'm talking about electricity right now, but home heating is also an opportunity, opportunity.
Okay, so what should people do? Should they change their electric company, or what should they do?
Well, they can continue right now to make some choices that are available in each state. But what you really have to do is to continue to make sure that renewable energy becomes part of the mix. And you do that by setting standards for how much of a percent is going to come from renewable energy. But in many cases, when you have a market system like we have in the Northeast, renewable energy bids in and is available and wins every time. So that lowers the cost of electricity for all of us, and it lowers the carbon emissions. So part of it is just making sure that renewable energy keeps getting cheaper and that decisions are made on the basis of what you would want. What's the cleanest and cheapest? And then that continues to drive the market moving forward.
Do you call your selectmen, or do you call your
congressmen? Well, how about, wait a second. The thing we raised in the debate, we did a gubernatorial debate with Jay Gonzalez and Charlie Baker. One divide there was Jay Gonzalez's contention, the Democratic nominee, obviously, was no more gas pipelines. Yeah. Baker basically said, I'm paraphrasing, I don't want to speak for the governor, obviously, I haven't made a decision yet. What is the right decision about new gas pipelines?
Well, here's the interesting thing. We've been able to make tremendous progress from a health perspective to reduce air pollution by shifting from coal to natural gas.
Right.
And we did that with, clean energy being available, and we did it through regulation. Two of the things that this administration isn't enamored with.
Right.
But when we did that, we found that we were not only healthier, but we saved a ton of money. And so you can continue to use the same type of strategy moving forward. It works. Look at what's best for people and make decisions accordingly. Now, I know that they're looking at the transportation sector the same way, I think the challenge we have now is to make sure that we're not continuing to invest in natural gas, which is also a fossil fuel.
So does that mean no more new pipelines?
That may mean no more new pipelines, as long as you can continue to have energy reliability. Mm-hmm. And batteries are beginning to escalate in terms of their availability and their cost going down, so that you can actually capture renewable energy and allow it to be available in times of high demand. So the challenge that we have is that natural gas was great, but continued investment in natural gas infrastructure means that if we need to escalate our reductions quicker, if we now know that the climate is changing faster than we anticipated, we have to rethink that and make sure that natural gas as a bridge fuel doesn't continue to be a bridge for the next 40 years.
So we're talking to Gina McCarthy. She ran the EPA for Barack Obama. First thing is, I shouldn't ask you this on the air, but rather than Marjorie texting me at 11 o'clock at night in a panic, can she start texting you about this?
Totally.
Can you just give
her a
cell?
I will privately give her
okay,
my
fine.
Cell phone number.
But I want to talk politics for a couple of minutes.
No, I want to talk what individuals can do.
Okay, fine. We'll do that too. But politics for a minute. The first time I met you, I don't know, a year ago or so ago, you mentioned that the tradition with cabinet secretaries is the outgoing one places a call to the incoming one and says, happy to meet and talk, even if you're of different parties, et cetera. You mentioned you, of course, placed the call to the legendary Scott Pruitt. Has he returned that yet or no? He never got
no,
it before
no,
he left.
Okay.
So
no,
here's what I want to know about the Scott Pruitts, the Ryan Zinkes, a guy who's, leaving ahead of the law at the Interior Department, Andrew Wheeler, the coal lobbyist.
EPA?
You know this world. Do these people, do they really believe the crap that they espouse? I'm serious about this. Or do they, of course, know that this denial thing is completely absurd, but they're just captive of in the fossil fuel industries. Which is it? Forget Donald Trump for a second, because he's an odd duck unto himself. But the people you meet who are on the other side of the climate change thing, do they really believe this is not a threat?
I'm sitting here with a puzzled look on my face because I don't know if I can answer that question. You know, I ask myself that a lot. I mean, I do believe in people. I love people. I'm in the public sector because I think if you talk straight enough with people, you give them information, and then you debate an issue, you can usually come to a consensus and you can keep making progress. I don't know what essentially motivates people. I know some of the consultants, it's who they get paid
by,
that influences what they say. But in the end, you know, we all have to inhabit this earth. And I don't know what they think about their kids and their kids' future and their health today.
Jim, how about the meteorologists, all your buddies?
They're not all my buddies. The meteorology community is still a little of an outlier.
Really far behind. It's incredible to me. That's one of the things I think is so upsetting, is that when you have these terrible storms, when you have these wildfires, that the people who are reporting on it and the meteorologists who are talking about it are not constantly referring to the connection between climate change and, you know, these wildfires.
Which does make it real. I have one more thing before you can end, Marjorie, with the whole notion of what can individuals do. One of the things I'm still confused about, Gina McCarthy, is we read almost every day, and you've told me this too, that the United States cannot formally pull out of the Paris Climate Accord until 2020. Charlie Sennett from the Ground Truth told us the deadline is a few days after the election.
Right.
Actually, talk about high stakes, and almost the timing couldn't be better. Does that mean that if there's an administration change, whether it's a Republican challenging Trump or a Democrat who beats Trump or whoever it is, does that mean that essentially on a dime, the next president could reverse what Donald Trump did vis-a-vis this international accord?
Yes.
Yeah, on the that's it. Essentially, the damage that is being done internationally, I don't mean what we're doing with regulatory repeal and that sort of thing and change. The international damage by not buying into pulling out of the Paris Climate Accord, the actual impact, other than, let's say, psychological is a poor choice of word. You know what I mean?
But yeah, I do.
As the most powerful nation in the world, is only that until this 2020 date. And if Trump is reelected and he decides to move forward with this, then it all becomes real. And if he isn't, and if he's replaced by someone who actually believes in science, it can be undone on the spot. Is that yes?
Yes.
Okay, fine.
As far as I know, that's the case, because I don't think there's any system in place for people to pull out.
Okay.
Before we go, I know, you know, changing to LED lights is not going to save the world, obviously, but what can people do to change the politics, change the notions about the dangers from diseases, et cetera? And what can they just do in their individual way to help?
Well, let me just list a couple of things. And let me begin by something a little squishy. I think they can talk about climate change.
Yeah.
You know, I think the thing that bothers me is climate change is something you don't seem to talk about in mixed company.
Yeah, it's like sex and religion.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know.
And that really drives me nuts.
Me too.
We have to depoliticize it.
Yeah.
And not be afraid of it, but simply go, okay, the world's changing. What do we do? Which is what the United States has always done. You know, that's our strength, is we can innovate.
Yeah.
And we lead.
Was our
and
strength.
And so when you get around the Christmas tree, or your when you get around, you know, any kind of holiday that you pull together, no matter what your religion, you know, just talk about it. You know, let's see if we can't, at least among families, agree to disagree. But the one thing that I'm trying to say is that at Harvard, and I'm at the School of Public Health, is if you care about public health, you have to care about climate. You know, you don't have to fight about climate change. The exact same things you'd want in your energy system to keep you healthy are the exact same things you want to do for climate change, because carbon pollution is always mixed with everything else. If you think fossil fuels are delicious to keep around forever, then think about air pollution. Think about soil contamination.
Yeah.
Think about plastics in the ocean, which are oil-based. All of the things that we worry about from our health perspective, many of them go down to the unnatural products and the burning of fossil fuels that the fossil fuel industry produces. And we have to just think about getting away from it. On your individual life, you don't just have to change light bulbs. Go energy efficient. Call your utility providers. Get people out there to take a look at your house and how you can become more energy efficient. Go beyond that and think about how you can actually use ground source heat pumps and other technologies that were always too expensive that now are competitive for your heat. Demand electricity with renewable
energy.
Oh, it's so cool. This is a way to both heat and cool your home that uses the energy that's in the ground in order to...
Marjorie. She's
gasping at this, Jim.
I've not heard about it.
All right, we can discuss it because I know we don't have a lot of time. But it's the coolest thing ever. It means that you can actually decrease your home heating bill enormously by giving it a boost from the energy that exists in the ground. So it's just really cool stuff. And this is now not expensive. Every time we find these things, only sort of elitist, or they tell us only the rich people can afford it. But when you kick it off, when you have a government and an infrastructure with public, you know, public servants who care about the public, they figure out a way to early finance these things, and then the cost goes down, and then it's available to everyone. And if you don't think that carbon pollution is keeping the poor down, then you're not watching what's happening here. Because like every other source of pollution, this is a justice issue as well.
Yeah.
So if you care about health, if you care about having food on your table, if you care about water and clean drinking water, if you care about your kids, this is where it's at. Don't be afraid of climate change. Jump on it like every other problem that this country's had, because there are many cities that are. I'm proud of the work in this state. I'm proud that work started with communities at the local level pushing the state to do something. I'm proud of Reggie. I'll be proud of the new Transportation and Climate Initiative. And we'll just have to keep plugging, even though we have leadership that's absent at the federal level. It's never stopped us before. New England doesn't care about that. We just keep moving forward. We do what we have to do.
Okay, she'll be back tomorrow and Friday and next week and the following.
Okay.
Gina McCarthy, it's great to see you as well.
Okay. Happy holidays.
Happy holiday to you, too.
Ground source heat pumps right away. That sounds ground's a little frozen at the moment. Maybe in the spring. I don't know. Gina McCarthy was the EPA administrator during the Obama administration. She now runs the Center for Climate Health and the Global Environment at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Gina McCarthy, great to talk to you. Thank you very much. Coming up, we're opening the lines and asking you about another stress level, your holiday stress level. 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If there was ever a sign, this is unbelievable. If there was ever a sign that holiday stress is real and pronounced this year, it's this. Popeyes, you know, the chicken joint,
yep,
is introducing the emotional support chicken. This is true. It's actually a fried chicken meal in a specially designed carrier box. It looks like a chicken to be sold at limited airport eateries. I hate the word eatery. I don't know why I said that. Limited airport, you know, Popeyes, to ease the anxious traveler. That's how the fried chicken franchise is coping with holiday stress. What about you? Where are your stress levels as we approach Christmas and New Year's? Are you behind on shopping? Have you already maxed out your credit cards? Do you have more invitations than you care to RSVP to? Are you ballooning up? Is the burden of a happy holiday all it takes to stress you out? The number is 877-301-8970. You know, I don't have expertise in many areas.
Yep.
This is one of the areas
one
I
of your
do.
Areas.
Thank you. I just said that. Now, here's the deal. Let me sum this up.
Okay.
There's too much family. I can't do anything about that.
Yep.
There is too much food. I don't want to do anything about that. And there's too much gift giving, which
uh-huh.
means there's financial stress.
That's
for
true.
For that, I have a solution. You ready for this?
I'm ready.
This is a radical plan,
radical
by the way.
Plan.
I'm sort of going to add it to my list of bands. I just came up with this last night.
Ah, Jack, get ready. Here
okay.
comes another band.
No, here. By the way, I think you're going to like this. Starting this Christmas, no gifts to anybody over, I don't know, let's pick an age. Let's say 13. Nobody over 13. gets gifts. It's fine. You socialize with them. If you want to go out to a restaurant with everybody, that's fine. No gift giving. Not only would it reduce the stress of having to decide what they'd like, you know, do they want a salami of the month club? Do they want red wool socks up to their knees? Whatever it is, wine, champagne. But it would save you a boatload of money. What do you think about?
Well, I think I believe your children are over 13.
Okay, an exception for that. So, no,
exception
obviously,
that.
An exception for your grown children.
Most people have a spouse they might want to give to.
No, forget that.
Forget the spouse?
No adults except your grown. And by the way, grown children, you can do a symbolic thing.
How about your mother-in-law or your elderly grandmother?
No, there's not much time left, so it's... No, I'm only kidding. Don't get upset.
Okay, so your rule is just give to your
children. Children. No, not to your children. I mean, your children, I was making an exception. Once they reach your 20s, it's ridiculous for them, too. Nobody except little kids.
Your kids are in their 20s.
I know.
Are you buying presents for them? Yes,
maybe
you are.
Maybe I did. Next year I won't. But can I get a thought out here without you like making a fool out of me?
This is an unrealistic.
It's not unrealistic. No gift. Can I say it again? Mm. No gift. Think about this for a second, because I can't believe you're fighting me. You're the most stressed out person at Christmas I've ever seen.
Because you buy gifts for. I mean, I must say you have expanded my gift giving frontiers. I didn't used to give gifts to all these people. No, you run around buying like multiple gifts.
No,
to
I don't
people,
anymore.
And then we
no,
split
here's
the cost.
My deal. If someone is over, can I repeat this?
Okay.
If someone this is what we want to know your thoughts on 877-301-8970. By the way, if you have other ideas, whether you like this one or not, about reducing holiday stress, or you don't have holiday stress for whatever reason, share that with us. My thesis is the biggest stress is the financial stress, and the way to relieve the
Huge.
Financial stress,
everyone goes into debt,
and the selection stress,
people
which is also torturous,
gain lots of weight and they go into debt.
No gifts for people over, pick an age, 12, 13, 10,
Are
whatever,
you crazy?
Whatever it is. Okay, 877-301-8970. So do you have
30.
An idea? What are your ideas? You have no ideas on this, how to reduce stress. I do. Don't ridicule me.
Well, I just give immediate family,
really?
As opposed to like everyone that I know. Mm. Well, and you are giving gifts to the sanitation workers, Tim.
Well, I know. That was
So if you're giving gifts to
now.
The sanitation
Only
workers,
the child
to the
sanitation
mailman,
workers.
To the newspaper
First
delivery
First of all, they're
person,
called mail carriers.
Mail carriers.
Mailman was
if you're
like
giving
a century
gifts
ago.
To all of them, all the people that work for you and beside you and all those kinds of things, before you know it, you're up to 50 people.
Exactly.
Tim.
That is my point. This is a new era, and I'm going to reduce my stress. And by the way, on the food front, someone wrote me last night and said they think it's the year I should probably end the intravenous use of gravy into my system. I'm not ready for that. Thing at a time.
This is not
but
funny.
Not this year.
But there was a story in front of me. It was dated in October.
New York Times.
Headline,
I read it.
The
I
headline was, this is the least you'll weigh all year.
I know, it's true.
Sorry that we just get fatter and fatter from October up through New Year's Eve. So we have a long way to go.
But I can't solve that one. I mean, if you want to talk about that, it's fine. Weight gain is a real serious problem in the holidays. Marjorie thinks that's funny, apparently. I don't think it's funny. Listen to her. I think that's proof. But I have solved, if people were mature enough to handle it, obviously Marjorie is not, the notion that children over a certain age, you can set your own age limit,
I'll
whatever
believe
it
that
is.
When I see it.
People above a certain age simply do not get gifts. You can hug them with their permission because it's a different era. You can shake their hand. You can thank them for being your friend, your family member, your coworker.
You know,
do whatever you
in
want.
In a moment of seriousness,
yeah.
I think it would be great if we didn't give gifts at Christmas. Think about how wonderful Thanksgiving is. Nobody's giving any gifts. Everybody just
a very good point. That's even
eat.
A better point.
And you could decorate. You could have the tree. You could have all the beautiful lights. Just no gifts to anybody over 16.
So after 10 minutes of mocking me, you totally agree
with
my idea.
I'm mocking you because you're not going to do it.
Oh, I am totally going to do it.
No, you're not going to do it, Jim. You just told me that you were in a panic and you're
Can I tell you
off
something?
No,
in all seriousness, I wasn't going to say this to you.
Oh, we have. Last Jack night, just sent us his list of things that you've banned.
Jack's been following us for the 19 years we were on the radio. What are some of the things I proposed banning? God, just read them, Marjorie. We don't have time for this.
You can't have fast drive-through at fast
food. No, drive-ins are a bad idea.
You want to ban Yankee swaps.
I do want to ban Yankee swaps.
I think you might rethink that, considering your position of
just
not giving
going.
Any presents.
Just keep going. What else is on the list?
You want to ban fake Christmas trees.
Toboggans.
School bake sales.
Yes, I do.
16-year-old drivers, 65-year-old plus drivers,
yeah.
The lottery, eating
okay,
and drinking
well, fine.
Cars,
you made your
toboggans,
point.
Sledding. Everyone has to wear helmets, even in cars, smoking on the beach. I mean, the list goes on for pages.
Well, which of those do you not think are inappropriate
for footballs? You want to ban peeps.
Peeps. I did want to ban peeps. I still do, actually. I mean, what value do they have? 877-301-8970. You're really not helping this discussion, actually. You're really not. We're trying to reduce stress levels, and obviously Marjorie is suffering from it. Here, around the holidays, I have a concrete suggestion. I would like to know what your response is to that or any other suggestion you want to share with your fellow listeners about reducing holiday stress. Go ahead, Marjorie. Let's take some calls.
Okay, Liz, you're calling from Rhode Island. Hi,
you
Liz.
You are. Hi, Liz.
Hi. How y'all doing today?
Excellent.
Great.
Excellent. Go ahead.
Well, I am great because I just got a gift from my boss in the state of Massachusetts, which turns out to be some pot.
Your boss?
I can leave. Well, you can legally give adults these types of things.
You can.
So not only did I receive a happy gift that was unexpected, but my stress level is for sure going to be lowered later today.
Well, that's actually a better solution than mine, Liz, have to say.
Really?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Out of the box, your boss giving you some weed for the holidays.
We don't need to know
it.
The name of the company necessarily, but what line of work are you in there, Liz? What is it?
I'm in the creative arts.
Of course you are. Liz, thank you very much. That was an excellent open to this discussion about reducing stress. 877-301-8970. Kathy in Worcester, you are next on Boston Public Radio with Marjorie Egan and me, Jim Browdy. Hi.
Hi, guys. Love you guys. First time caller.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, that's great. Hi. What's up? What are your thoughts?
So, Jim, I couldn't agree with you more.
Oh.
I think it's a great idea to just give presents to kids. My husband and I decided to do that several years ago.
Oh.
We don't get each other gifts. We just spend time together and watch the kids open their gifts. But I like your idea of cutting it off at 13. We hadn't decided what age yet.
Kathy, first of all, you're not only a first-time caller, you're the smartest caller we've had in months. That's number one. Number two, how do your adult friends and family members, how did they react in year one to the fact that you didn't give gifts? And I assume there was some discomfort because you probably got some from adults but didn't return the favor. How'd that work out?
Right. So the first time it was a little awkward. Mm-hmm. There might have been a few hurt feelings, but you know, now it's been several years and they just know that we're committed to it. So it's okay now. But at first, yeah, there were some awkward moments at
transition,
first, but
yeah.
People adjust and they're fine.
By the way, and tell Marjorie, again, who's ridiculing my idea,
yep.
What has it done to your and your husband's stress level the last few years?
Oh, it's just so much less stressful.
Listen
it's
to
just
her.
Easier because he and I can kind of celebrate each other and give each other things at other times when there's not this pressure of the holiday to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's just so much easier. It's really much less stressful and not nearly as much money, too, which is always good.
Well, Kathy, great also, first call. Thank you.
There comes a point where your children
Merry
need
Christmas.
To start giving you gifts if you're giving them
yeah.
gifts. And then the stress is on them to come up with yeah. stuff to give you. And they usually don't have any money because they're mm-hmm. just in their first jobs. They're just out of high
That's
school, just out of college and stuff like that. So, but, you know, some people are much more creative. I will say you are very creative in your gift-giving ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm not. And some people are quite clever.
Well, wait
about
a second.
It.
While the compliment is much appreciated, mm-hmm. I would say the fact that I not only gave you one crock pot that you never used, but gave you two crock pots 2 years in a row that you never used is not a mark of creativity, is it?
Well, I think it's sort of a mark of a rather self-involved personality. Because I've noticed over the years,
pot.
Jim, that things that you like, you assume everybody else likes and wants.
Why wouldn't they?
And that's the thing.
Exactly.
Because apparently you have a fondness for red socks. You thought that
I do.
I
red
might
wool
like
socks.
Red
somewhere.
Wool socks.
Yeah.
And because you like crock pots,
mm-hmm.
You thought that everyone else, I'm sure many people on your list got crock pots.
How much have you enjoyed using either of the crock pots?
I have not opened either of the crock pots, but this year I'm giving them away. I have two daughters, and maybe they want them.
Is that
them.
True? They're each
and if
getting
they,
one?
They're wrapped and under the tree. If they don't want them, I guess we'll give them to charity.
Let's go to Chris and JP. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Chris.
Hello. In my family, we've tried various things, and they never work. People still want to give gifts. But I have a friend. They've been doing it for decades. You only give presents to people who are younger than you.
Oh, that is a
so
variation
grandpa
on a theme.
Grandpa gives a lot of presents.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, so grandpa gives a lot of presents. The youngest kid's off the hook. You know, the kids only give to their younger siblings.
And how's that working out? How do people react to that?
They've been doing that for at least 40 years.
And?
It works.
But what about poor grandpa? His stress level must be through the roof. It seems like you should be able to relax a little bit more once you get to be, you know, 70 or 80, don't you think?
Yeah, what about that, Chris?
Well, grandpa isn't working anymore.
Yeah.
He doesn't have work stress. He's got more time to think about it. And they also don't go overboard with huge numbers of gifts.
Yeah.
So...
Well, I like it. And you, by the way, you sound incredibly calm, too, by the way. So obviously whatever's working in your family is working for you. Chris, thank you very much for the call. These are concrete suggestions, not just BS rhetoric about how to resolve the stress thing.
You know what happens? Not everybody's buying things online.
No.
You're getting your gift messages and before Christmas. I mean, if people have bought things for you online, sometimes you get an email.
Oh, that's horrible.
I learned that I'm getting a succulent of the month club membership.
You are?
Mm-hmm.
Well, by the way, it's funny you should say that because you said that I'm...
Is that from you?
No, I'm violating...
Succulent of the month?
I am violating my own notion because I'm a big gift giver, which I used to be.
Yep.
I want you to know, last night I went online. I ordered you a succulent of the month club membership. And just as soon as I was about to hit submit, I hit delete. And so not only am I honoring my own mandate, but the Succulent of the Month Club membership or whatever it is you've got. What is the Succulent of the Month? What is it? Well, it's not from me, believe
me. I'm getting some plants. It's a succulent.
Oh, it is?
And the Farmer's Almanac, the old Farmer's Almanac, said that they're very in this year, Jim.
Succulents are?
So I'll be cutting edge in terms of the plants in my house.
Okay, it's not from me. I was going to send it to you, but I decided not to.
We're talking about holiday stress, asking you what's causing it, what are your coping mechanisms, do you think we need to cut down on the present giving? Jim's rule is nobody gets a present who's over 13. Wow. We'll wait to see if that happens. The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Brady and Marjorie. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the holidays and your stress levels. And now we'd like, and I made a, I thought a pretty thoughtful proposal that you don't give gifts to anybody under 13 or over 13, which I think is great, actually. But we can talk about that. But now we'd like to focus on, or at least add one particular cause of anxiety. And it's the snail mail version of the most annoying Facebook post ever written. And obviously, I'm talking about the Holiday Family Newsletter. We want to know if you're on the receiving end of these. Are you guilty of sending them? Do they annoy you as much as they rankle me? And, you know, in some examples, when we discuss this every year, why does anyone think we care if Buffy and Chip got early admission to Harvard? Or do you think anybody really cares that your golden retriever aced the obedience school thing? I'm serious. My reaction is, what's her name? Melania Trump, when she said, I really don't care. Do you? I have one, well, actually, I have two people in my life of the, I get about a dozen of these every year.
Wow.
Two that are really, really, really good, not over the line, not incredibly full of self-praise and what's that thing called we learned humble bragging kind of thing, which I really, Michael Norton taught us about humble bragging maybe a year or two ago. How do you feel about these things? You probably love them because you're that kind of sappy kind of thing.
Well, I get one from my best friend, but she doesn't do a bragging one.
Oh, well, that's okay.
She'll do kind of the highs and lows of the year, you know, so that's not bad. It's sort of an update on what she's been up to. So that one's
okay. But most of them are pretty self-absorbed.
There were like people, the pictures people post on Facebook, they're just, you know, it's your wonderful vacation or your wonderful dinner out or the food you ate or something like that, and they're kind of obnoxious. I don't like them.
So that's another proposal I have. Jack, are you listening? I would not only ban gift giving to anyone over 13 years old, I would ban these family Christmas holiday newsletter things, which I think are just an unmitigated disaster.
We have some good ideas from our listeners.
Oh, we do? Okay.
Yes.
Like what?
Well, let's begin with poor Steve. He says, holiday stress? I work for FedEx. Enough said.
Can you imagine, by the way?
Kevin says, in our family, kids are 18, under 18, get gifts. After 18, you participate in the Yankee swap if you want to. No obligation. Mm. And she and her husband only give each other a home upgrade. Like this year, they got new silverware. She said it really reduces.
That's actually good. That's a nice
idea. Marisa says, my husband and I have just been getting each other stocking stuffers for years, light and fun, nothing really we want, that we can save up for the big ticket items.
I like that too.
A lot of people think that you reduce stress by not giving. Starting 3 years ago, my two adult children and I decided to stop exchanging gifts, not just for Christmas, but for birthdays, Mother's Days, etc.
Wow.
So there you go. And they spend the money and give to charities in each other's name. Don't give to Donald Trump's charity because it's just been shut down by Attorney General of
New
York
State. Yeah, because it was like an exploding violation of law. We'll talk to Juliet about that in a minute. Yeah, but
Jack,
I was about to agree, before you go ahead, I was about to agree with that first one you read, which said we don't do any gift giving for people over whatever, we just do Yankee swap. And I was nodding in agreement until I realized I proposed banning the Yankee swap as well.
Well, I just printed out the list of bans.
You did?
It's out in the hallway.
Oh,
that's from Jack.
Thank you,
and Jack just emailed in. But he has a different perspective on this.
What's this?
If you don't get joy out of gift giving at Christmas, you really don't get Christmas. Fewer gifts given and received means less joy.
Oh, that's not true. There are other things you can do. A hearty handshake.
Well, Jack
example.
Is the man. A hearty handshake.
Really hard.
Okay.
Sometimes if you really feel close to someone, you clasp that with a second hand.
It's a hearty handshake. Or you do the Bill, if you are one of those sexual harassers, you do the Bill Clinton handshake where you shake
your
hands
up the arm.
And one hand is on your palm to palm, then he's moving up your elbow. And he's moving up to your bicep.
What's the name
he's
of the book?
Up to
it was
your shoulder
written by
before
anonymous
you know it,
we found out what his name was.
Trouble, Primary Colors.
Primary Colors opens
oh my God.
With that
great.
Scene with the Bill Clinton character moving his hand up the
and
arm.
And if you're looking for a good movie to sit and watch over Christmas, it's an old one, but it's John Travolta playing Bill
he's
Clinton
good in that
Primary
movie,
Colors.
I thought, too.
It's really good.
Jackie and Worcester, you're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about holiday stress and how to relieve it. Hi there, Jackie.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
Listen, I have a wonderful teaching moment.
What's that?
For teenagers and 20-year-olds for Christmas.
What's that?
Donate to your favorite charity.
Oh.
And that, yeah.
Wait a second. So you mean you say to a teenager, I will make a donation in your name to your favorite charity. Tell me. I love that idea, actually. I love that idea. Do you actually do that, or that's an abstract?
Yes.
Good.
I have an autistic son,
yeah.
And a lot of the family members do donate. And I have an uncle who donates to a school every year
My
son had gone to.
That's great.
I just think it's something that should make you feel you matter.
Well, you know, not only is it great for all the reasons you mentioned, Jackie, it's also you're not giving somebody some crap that they have no interest in.
Right.
That they're either going to re-gift. I mean, something actually good comes out of that kind of gift giving. So that's a wonderful idea, Jackie, and thanks for sharing it with us. We appreciate it. Merry Christmas to you.
You know, I wonder if you're the tax man.
I am a tax man.
People still get deductions for charity. They don't?
No. I mean,
is really too bad.
Well, there's a real...
I think charity's going to suffer because
I think
of that.
They are too at the end of the year, actually, because a lot of people right for December 31st or right up to December 31st through their charitable giving thing.
So none of the donations you give to the Boys Club or Hope for Little Wanderers or any of that is going
to
matter.
I'll explain it to you a little bit more in a couple of seconds here.
Okay.
Let's keep taking phone calls.
Let's go to Karen in Holden. Hi, Karen.
Hey, Karen.
Hi. You guys are great. Love listening to your show.
Thank
and thanks
you.
For taking the
Thank
call.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Jim, I do somewhat agree with your suggestion, except I would do it a little differently.
What's up?
Instead of limiting the age, we get stressed because I do both Hanukkah and Christmas, and it just gets overwhelming. So what if you just give one thoughtful gift, just one, you know, sort of on the idea of, you know, Hanukkah, one every night for 8 days. But we don't even give gifts anymore because it's been just so overwhelming. But I think some people like a gift. So, you know, maybe you say you agree one gift, regardless of age, just one gift. Either it has to be thoughtful.
I like that. I like that, too. I mean, I like that, actually. Anything that is creative that reduces the stress but doesn't totally get you out of the seasonal mood. I like that. That's a creative suggestion there, Karen. I like that.
You know, thank you, Karen, for the call. Ever since we got friendly with Michael Norton from Harvard Business School, who we talked to from time to time about his great research, and he wrote that book about happier spending of your money.
Yeah.
I'm big on giving experience. I think that's a wonderful thing. You know, tickets to things or massages or a weekend away or something like that. That's kind of a neat idea.
No, but by the way, his whole thesis is you're going to remember that. It's going to mean much more to you than even if you like a gift.
Right.
You shove it in the closet or use it. I am a totally. Well, you give theater tickets. Can I say that? I'm allowed to do kids. You do theater tickets, which is really great.
Paul says he's defending these letters. He says that it's common for people to lose touch over time, and they even those people they really enjoy. And he said he'd been getting a yearly letter from a friend he made in Australia for years and years until last year. You know what happened?
No, I don't.
Well, he looked him up and he died.
He did. He did. Well, that's. It's amazing that you find that to be humorous. But, you know, for those who think Marjorie's nicer than I am, which almost all of you do, I'm not laughing at that. Marjorie is like doubled over, almost with cramps, laughing at the death of that Australian. And in fact, she won't be talking for a few minutes on the show. Why don't you say something, Marjorie? Go ahead.
It's not funny. I don't know why I'm laughing at it.
I know. It's horrible. It's a death and the... But that generally I have found that's not, I mean, the interesting part of that, one of the only pluses of the family holiday letter is you generally do know if you're not that close to the person when they stop. If they've been coming every single year, you realize that probably means something else has stopped in
that's
that person's
true.
Life.
That's true. That's true. But he says, you know, he likes a lot of the people that send him, the other people who are alive who send them, they're very funny.
Yeah, the ones from people alive are good.
And he knows that they, of course, are not dead.
Yeah, that's another good point. Now, you've made
Rama
a few good points.
From Gloucester.
Thank you for that. Hello.
Hello.
Hello to you.
Good morning, you folks. Marjorie, you might be nicer than Jim, but you've been interrupting him an inordinate amount this morning. And
He never
interrupts you. So
thank
you.
Exactly.
That's a good point. He never does. He never does.
Never ever. He's a saint.
he's a saint.
But anyways, I called him the other day and. Suggested the ban, Jim, because you're talking about regifting. I said regift only, no buying of presents. So let's ban the buying of presents. So I appreciate you putting, you know, being obviously you thought about this a lot the last couple of days. So thank you for bringing it to the fore and elucidating.
Well, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Yeah, but there was another thing I wanted to say the other day was a friend of mine's family has instituted a thing that I'm going to try to do with our family, and that's they don't buy gifts at all. They all the money that we're going to spend, they bring it in cash, they throw it in a basket at Christmas, make a nice ritual out of it, and then they the host writes a check and donates it to the charity of their choice that year.
Oh, well, that's a nice one. That's a nice tradition, don't you think?
You know, by the way,
I'm
sorry about
time.
Let me just say, because I don't want to give people bad advice on this charitable deduction thing. You should look it up. The problem is the standard deduction is much larger, which means more people are going to take it, and fewer will take the itemized deduction, which is where you do charitable things. Plus, there's now a cap. Google the thing. So it's not gone, but charitable giving, which we hope you'll do anyway, is a lot less appealing as a tax deduction vehicle than it was before Trumpian tax reform. So that's check it out for yourself. I'm sorry, Marjorie.
We're going to talk to Juliet Kayyem.
We are.
Coming up about lots of things, Mueller and other events. Juliet Kayyem, our national security expert, she's next.
At noon on today's Boston Public Radio, President Trump is caving on his border wall. Facebook has been misleading about its privacy wall, cutting out a chink for other tech giants to peep through. And U.S. officials refuse to take responsibility for the death of a migrant girl. At noon, national security expert Juliet Kayyem joins us for these headlines and more. Then we make the French connection with Arnaud Montré. He's the Consul General of France here in Boston.
Then it's off to Santa's other workshop, the mall. With retail habits changing, malls across the country shutting down, how is Mall Santa, their workforce, adapting? And how do you keep their beard so white? Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us for that. If you missed Hamilton, how about 1776? WGBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen joins us to talk about the musical's revival. Then MIT economist John Gruber discusses the survival of Obamacare and what a judge's latest actions to strike it down could mean.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Eastern Brady. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So here with us in Studio 3 to go over the latest national security headlines, Juliette Kayyem. Juliette's on the faculty of Harvard's Kennedy School, an analyst for CNN, CEO of Zemcar. And I want to personally thank you. I know you had to come back fast because obviously you didn't want to leave Anderson Cooper and Don Lemon's Christmas parties in
New
York City.
So I said I went to the parties because I do work for CNN, I don't get to see them because I'm alone in a room
Newton. Are you kidding?
And I don't get invited to much here. Yeah. I didn't get invited to the WGBH Christmas party. I don't know why. So they invited me, and they were really fun. Yeah. They were.
Okay. I bet they were really fun.
Yeah. Anderson Cooper had his at his house.
Excuse me.
I brought a few things back. No, I'm joking.
We're talking to Juliette Kayyem.
So speaking of CNN, we just turned
on... Do you
know
who's really pretty, though, in real life?
Who?
Brooke Baldwin. She's pretty on air, too.
She's good. She's smart
and she's
good.
Smart
I think she's good.
Good.
I like her a lot.
She's also really pretty.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of them are really pretty.
Like us.
Anderson Cooper's not so bad looking either.
He's not. Although, I have a friend who swoons over Chris Cuomo every night. She thinks he looks like Mark Antony in the Roman...
He could be in the Roman kind of thing.
Yeah. You know, with the little curls and all that kind of stuff. Anyway, we just heard on CNN that the government we're avoiding a shutdown. Mitch McConnell just announced that there's a funding through February 8th.
We're
going to avoid a...
Well, it's not clear that Trump signed off. Schumer and McConnell have signed off in the Senate.
I think that's where we are, is that you have agreement for a continuing resolution, which is no way to run a government. But nonetheless, it will stop us from having a shutdown.
President has said he's willing to forgo the border wall.
Yeah, it doesn't mean he'll buy any deal.
I mean, he said that yesterday.
But,
today is today. And so, you can't run a government this way. My guess is McConnell had assurances from the White House that they would get the CR, but he hasn't gotten final approval. And so Schumer and McConnell are just sitting around waiting for, is the president going to sign this thing to keep this government in place through March? I mean, can you believe it? And, coming from an agency where I had worked at Homeland Security and previously at Department of Justice, you can't budget. You can't hire. You can't expend money because you don't know if it's going to be there on the other end.
You know, the interesting thing, we asked John King, your CNN colleague, about this yesterday. I think if you were to ask somebody, what's the promise that candidate Trump made that was higher profile than any other, it was building the wall and Mexico paying. Forget Mexico paying with this absurd notion that NAFTA, the savings on the new NAFTA, do it. Ann Coulter, one of my favorite people, just said the Trump presidency is a joke without the wall. It seems to me that if this continuing resolution is agreed to and it goes to February 8th, by which date the Democrats will control the House, the notion that Donald Trump is ever going to get funding for a wall is somewhere close to zero. So what is he – assuming he makes it to 2020 and assuming he runs for re-election, what does he say about his – he just blames the Democrats?
He'll blame the Democrats. And, I mean, he's already softening his stance, at least on Twitter. Sarah Sanders had the best line yesterday. You have to run it, at the Kennedy School where I teach, like at School of Public Policy. She said, a reporter rightfully asked, we are so far away from the Mexicans' pain. This is now the taxpayers going to pay. And she says, it's not the taxpayers who are going to pay. We're just going to take money from other agencies.
Other federal taxpayer funded
agencies. Exactly.
Agency.
And we're like, okay, and those get money from what? God. He may have at one stage had a window for a wall. In fact, they did have an agreement on DACA for money for the wall on solving the DACA issue, the deferred
Dreamer. Huge money, not just $5 billion, like $20 billion.
Yeah, Democrats were willing to go down that path when it did not look like they would become the majority party in the House. And he balked at it. He had a deal and he just, couldn't see the benefit of that deal. Plus, he would have done well vis-a-vis the Dreamers. Now he's lost the House and he's not going to get that wall. He'll blame the Democrats. But when you think of the contortions and the cartwheels, the lies and the deployment of the military, everything around this fiction of the wall to support a silly policy that has dragged this country for 4 years now. I mean, he started mentioning the wall, you know, when he was campaigning. It's just abysmal. And we're suffering the consequences, which is we have a government that might be open for 12 more weeks.
Well, we are talking to Juliette Kayyem, fresh back from Anderson Cooper's mansion in New York City. Now, you know, this, you know, one of, you don't know me well. Well, you do know me well. But one thing I don't know if you know, one of my obsessions, and Marjorie will say I have many, near the top of my obsessions and outrages is that we don't have cameras and audio in federal courtrooms from the Supreme Court on down.
Yeah.
The fact that we could not hear this judge yesterday
excoriating
General
Flynn.
By the way,
excuse me, if this had been an elected judge, we would not have had this excoriation. That's another one of your obsessions. This is why we cannot have judges elected.
Disagree.
Because they have to be above worrying about how the Trump
base... Are you guys
actually
asking me about federal judicial policy?
No, no. We're not.
Okay,
but
good.
No, but what I want to say...
Okay,
fine.
I say that to listeners.
But it seems to me that this Flynn non-sentencing yesterday
that was, I can talk
is a
about the
major,
substance of that.
Major
yeah.
moment
well,
in
let's
this whole
put this,
thing.
Let's just put this in a little context, because this thing, I just was leaping with joy at this judge. Because, of course, Michael Flynn was supposedly going to avoid a prison sentence yesterday. Everybody expected it was going to be a light or no prison sentence because of his extensive cooperation in the Russia investigation. Then there was this memo from Flynn's lawyers last week implying that he'd been tricked and coerced and pushed by the FBI improperly. And this had been repeated by Fox News over and over by the president and all his defenders, talking about how he was victimized and tricked into lying probably by the FBI. And the judge would have none of it. And he says, this is the judge. And they, by the way, they thought this judge was going to be on their side. They were all excited about this judge on the pro-Trump in the pro-Trump media. The judge says instead, crushing their hopes, I cannot recall an instance of a court ever accepting a guilty plea from someone, Flynn, who did not maintain he was guilty. And I do not intend to start today. And then he quizzes Flynn on whether anybody tricked him, the FBI, all this kind of stuff. And Flynn says nobody tricked him.
Right.
He knew exactly what was going on, throwing this whole
entrapment argument out the window.
They've been talking about 4 days, and then he went on.
It's a remarkable thing that Flynn's lawyers, let alone Flynn, started to play this game before he was sentenced. Because if he had been sentenced because of, you know, double jeopardy, if he had been sentenced to no time, then he can come out and say, actually, I kind of was entrapped. And no one would, then his media people, Fox News and others would run with it. So he does it before, and then he opens up a window, which sort of played out the week before. So while there were a lot of people thinking he wasn't going to get any time, actually, over the last week, there were a lot of lawyers writing like, this is really risky on Flynn's part, because when Flynn's lawyers filed that he had been sort of pseudo entrapped into lying, that gave Mueller the opportunity to come back with a memo. What was that, Monday night? To come back with a memo saying, actually, here's the transcript or here's the notes after the meeting, which showed an FBI that that did not believe he was lying at the time, that was trying to jog his memory, was there for a intelligence investigation more so than a law enforcement. They were there to essentially assess how much had the Russians infiltrated. This is before collusion, had infiltrated the campaign. With that filing, which goes to the court then ran with it. And it is shocking. So that by the end of the hearing yesterday, Flynn's lawyers basically take a very narrow opening that the judge gave them and said, can we delay this? And Mueller's people, who have no incentive for Flynn to go to jail, even though he's a jerk, right, because he's been so helpful, agree to that. So a couple things with that. One is, what's going to happen between now and March? Will there be a pardon? Will there be more talking? We don't know. But the other is, we're now into, at the very least, March 2019 on this investigation with the first person who worked for the Trump White House to be sentenced will be
in
March.
Let me ask you the same question that I asked of John King yesterday.
Yeah.
Well, in many ways, this is good news because it totally, as you say, undercuts and eviscerates the whole entrapment, misconduct by the FBI argument, and then some. The concern I have is, why does the next cooperating witness cooperate in return for Mueller saying, I'll write, or the Southern District of New York or whatever it is, saying, we'll ask for only 2 weeks in jail or no jail time, when what's going to stick in his or her head and his or her lawyer's head is, you can't guarantee that in this environment that we're not going to get a judge. What is this, Sullivan? Was that his name?
Sullivan.
Sullivan. All right, we're not going to get a judge who's going to say, we don't care, so we're going to give you all the goods and we're not going to get anything.
So I think that's why, Mueller, who has sort of had a very calculated, very methodical approach, at least in the descriptions of what happened in the courtroom, you know, this may have been the first surprise for Mueller's team, that because I think they were looking at the long view, which is he's going to get no time and that, you know, people will start to agree to it. I think.
As you said, Juliet, had not these lawyers start talking about how the FBI trapped him, I think.
So you think that's the lesson?
That's the thing is that, Papadopoulos, remember he started spouting, started spouting off, but that was after he got 14 days. If you want to just, cultivate the conspiracy theories, do it after your sentence because they can't touch you again. And it was just, it was so bizarre. But I think that's a little, I think a little bit of this is that mind frame of that sort of right wing conspiracy theory is that Flynn, who knew he had not been entrapped, began to believe that he was entrapped. I, for the life of me, do not understand how Flynn's lawyers could have gone along with it. They knew exactly what the risk was of challenging the sanctity of the guilty plea. I'm just in shock. They're not bad
Maybe
lawyers.
Maybe that was a pardon thing. I don't know.
It could be.
President was spouting
and the president has never to this day viewed Mike Flynn as anything but a victim. While he's gone after Michael Cohen, it just it's been noted by many. His Twitter feed has always been sympathetic to Flynn and damning to Michael Cohen. They're doing the same thing.
Juliet, you've made a major contribution to Marjorie's life, as you know, when you introduced the concept of pacing the rage to us a couple of years ago. Marjorie has attempted to pace. Well, occasionally she does well, but occasionally there is something in Trump world that puts her totally over the edge, and this is it.
We are like frogs that got into the water when it was cool, and we're getting heated up slowly, and we're forgetting.
No, I'm talking about the charity thing.
That's
where you're going. Okay, yeah.
And it's important to point out, I think, from time to time, how outrageous some of this stuff is.
Yeah. So describe
it. Now, we have the Attorney General of New York State shutting down. Well, Trump agreed to shut it down, but she accused it of a shocking pattern of illegality, which was basically a piggy bank to fund. This is a charity where people are expecting their giving to charity to help people. Actually, they've been funding the legal settlements that Trump has had to pay, the portraits that he purchased of himself for $20,000 and up. Apparently, there was a fountain in front of the Plaza Hotel that Trump used to own. It needed to be fixed. His charity paid for that. She basically said it was so outrageously operated, and Trump, by the way, has agreed to shut it down, although he claims it's some ridiculous double standard. But it's so bad that the three Trump children, the three oldest, have been now barred from serving on the boards of any other nonprofit organizations in New York State.
That's huge.
Because of their stealing, essentially. Yeah. How many thousands of dollars?
So aren't they being criminally prosecuted rather than just being barred?
There might be fraud charges, but right now the investigation is on the Trump charity. So
you're going to donate to children. Give me your money. I'm going to donate to children. But instead, I'm going to buy a car.
Different take on this, just because. It's true. I mean, what he did in terms of saying that he was a charity and then what they were doing, which was essentially just a back way to get money and funds to his kids and to his pet projects, including this, 20-foot portrait that no one wanted that's sitting in some hotel or something like that. But I actually think no one who's smart with their money was giving to the Trump charity because they thought he was helping kids. You see that guy for 2 minutes. You know he doesn't wake up thinking about how can he give meaningful charitable donations. I think
people
it was a way.
People thought he was helping out veterans when he had
name,
that alternate.
Name a single contributor to the Trump Foundation or the Trump, you know, day.
I'll give it to you. The night of the debate or the night he was having a fit because he didn't get his way back during the campaign, he had that alternate night where he was raising
money. Oh, the veterans.
That's true.
That's true.
But I think these big dollar.
What happened to the money?
Right. I think you're right. And there might be a lawsuit by them, right? The people who contributed. Mm-hmm. But I think if you think about the big money, the $500,000, the million-dollar checks that were going into the Trump Foundation, that's the same tactic that the Saudis are using by staying in his hotel rooms.
But it's still
rooms.
Illegal.
Of course. But you know, this thing was fraudulent front end and back end. I mean, in the sense that people were paying Donald Trump and God knows who they are, but
so
getting
pay
benefits.
To play
it's pay to play. I mean,
about.
It clearly was. And in the document, she lists some of these contributors. These are not people who are waking up saying, "How can I help the wounded warriors?" Or, you know, "How can I help, you know, X, Y, or Z?" These are people waking up saying, "How can I line Donald Trump's pockets through the tax deduction of the charitable contribution, knowing where it's going?" I think, you know, and that's the shock of it all. So you, obviously, and they're going to get a tax bill in my mind. I mean, she, you know, Underwood, the acting AG, and there's a new one coming on, you know, the acting AG clearly has in her back pocket, "I'm now going to show where all this money went and you didn't pay taxes on it. Here's your tax bill." At the same time, the Democrats are going to get the taxes released and you are going to see a man who has not paid taxes for a very long time.
You know, when some people are trying to stay one step ahead of the law, they leave the country, they hide out.
Yeah.
This guy decided to run for president, essentially.
The line
that you read yesterday, you read the opening line in that Associated Press story about what's being
investigated.
Every element of his presidential and pre-presidential life
and personal
is under investigation by some authority. But can we go something that's in your – I mean, you are deeply – well, whatever. You're involved in the world in which things like Facebook operate.
Oh, good.
I don't understand why Mark Zuckerberg is not in more trouble.
Because he's the majority shareholder.
No. I don't mean publicly.
In his
company.
He is.
When he continues to talk, either do these phony apologies,
right,
and then talk about the privacy of his users or his number one thing, and then we read the lead story in today's New York Times that they've made a minor exception, minor being the alleged attempted humor, for the Facebooks, for the Googles, for the Spotify's,
Netflix's,
and others, to basically access the most personal data, including direct messages, text messages, things like that, to these major tech giants. It's unconscionable.
It's unconscionable.
I don't know if it's criminal,
this is pretty close. I mean, this is as bad as the Russia story because I think, I mean, first of all, I do think Zuckerberg, I do think, you know, Facebook has been damaged. I don't think he's going anywhere. They clearly lied or at least obfuscated when they had to testify, both Sheryl Sandberg and Mark Zuckerberg. They knew this was going on. You know, Facebook is, you know, what Facebook does is different than how Facebook makes money. And, you know, what it does is it apparently brings us together and we share. It makes money by actually selling all of that data. And that was that's the only way it could make money. And so I do think they're hurt. I think, you know, there's, you know, two things out of this that are just so shocking. One is that from a crisis management corporate perspective, they know all of this and they know it's going to come out. They do. None of this is going to be in it. This smoke and mirrors of, oh, Facebook only wants to bring people together and we're going to testify and not say anything meaningful, whatever, is just a joke, right? And I just sort of from a crisis management perspective, you're looking and you're like, they need like a new team there in that sense. The second is that Facebook clearly knows what's happening on its platform. So that gets to Russia. So the idea that they woke up after Trump won and, you know, Mark Zuckerberg's first words the day after in a speech he gave, he says, "There's no way Facebook had influence in this election." He now realizes it did. The idea that they didn't know it before the election, what was happening on the platform, who was buying what the Russians were doing. And we saw this new report that came out this week, which basically showed the extent of Russian infiltration on Facebook and Instagram is a joke. They clearly know what's happening on the platform. You experience Facebook for 5 minutes, and you know they know what you're interested in because you're, you know, and ads for a new, you know, dress show up, right? And so, for me, I don't know how this ends. I don't know if there'll be a new leadership.
How about Congress? One, learning a little something so they can ask an intelligent question.
And that is just
and then two, passing some laws around privacy. And by the way, if you think this is hyperbolic in this room that you're listening to with the three of us, go watch Frontline.
Oh my God,
Facebook's Dilemma. Was it a two-part series?
Two-part series.
Yeah,
we talked to the people who made it.
It
exposes these people for who they are and how deceitful they are
deceitful
in terms of what they communicate to the public.
Sheryl Sandberg, her whole kind of feminist icon thing is sort of teetering.
Well, yeah, my personal feeling is Lean In died with Me Too. I mean, the idea that women obviously struggle with balancing all, I get it, and we aren't as mature or aggressive as we do, but the idea that there weren't structural or sexist, it's not a structurally sexist world out there and personally sexist world out there. I mean, once Me Too came around, the idea that Lean In was women's problems is like a joke. But I think you're right. I think the branding has hurt all of them. And and look, Facebook does bring people together. It's in the sense of, you know, what your nieces and nephews are doing. It's just, they just don't seem to really want to fix it. And maybe they can't, because then they have no revenue, stream. If they begin to guard our privacy, and I obviously think of Facebook more. I mean, I get the privacy issue domestically, but the Russia stuff, and that they haven't come to terms with how they exacerbated what happened in 2016 is still shocking.
It's not
to
just
me.
Russia, by the way. When you see this documentary, if you haven't seen it already, they interview the
Burma,
guy from Google who, without Facebook, couldn't have started the Arab Spring. But that's the story most of us know. What we don't know is what Facebook users did to destroy the Arab Spring and destroy this activist and other activists' lives. In any case,
Absolutely.
We only have 2 minutes left. Mm. Can you give us a quick sort of a Cliff Notes version of this decision to by the Trump administration to pull out of Syria? His contention is, we can pull out, and I don't have the tweet in front of me. It's because one of the commitments, the only reason we were there under the Trump presidency, he calls his own presidency, was to eradicate ISIS. We have now conquered ISIS in Syria. We're leaving. Could you give us your quick thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, we're hearing it's going to be in 24 hours. So that ISIS is defeated was undermined by his own Joint Chiefs, who testified, I think, last month, saying that our presence is still needed in Syria, if only to stabilize peace, or to the extent, life essentially getting back to normal, and to, of course, check Syria, Russia, Iran, and ISIS. So what's my two-word takeaway? Russia wins. And I will be honest with you, Russia had already won. I mean, once Assad was clearly ensconced, this became just really an issue about just making sure ISIS did not reform, reintegrate, and become a threat to Western Europe or the United States. But this kind of dramatic exit for someone who did not quite understand military deployment in Syria for parts of it, this kind of abruptness is another ode.
A gift to Putin?
Gift to Putin, yeah. Oh my God. And the Russia press is playing it as that. So this is the, and our allies, let alone Senate Republican leadership, are completely caught off guard. Our allies are supporting the mission in Syria. They wake up to this. Lindsey Graham wakes up to this. He thinks it's a mistake. This is like bizarro world in the sense, why would you let your Joint Chiefs and other American U.S. institutions remark about the necessity of keeping some presence to check ISIS? Why would you let them testify in the days leading up to a decision to say ISIS has been defeated? No one believes ISIS has been defeated. And in fact, it's in hard times. That's why we should stay there, because it's closer to being defeated.
Nice to see you, Julia.
Bye, you guys. Happy holidays.
Happy
I think this
holidays
is it until
too,
the
too,
new
Julia.
Year.
That is correct.
Next time you go to Anderson's house, you can tell him I watch most nights.
I will.
Okay?
Yeah, and I'll be looking for that WGBH holiday party card. Thanks, people.
Bye. National security expert Julia Kime joins us every week. She's on the faculty of Harvard's Kennedy School. She's an analyst for CNN, and she's CEO of Zemcar. Juliet, thank you very much. Coming up, We'll get a different perspective on the yellow vest protests with the French Consul General to Boston. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. It's time for the French Connection. Joining us here in Studio 3 is Arnaud Montré. He's Boston's Consul General of France. He's with us for a diplomat's take on some of the current events in France and to talk about the role of the French consul in Boston. Consul General, it's a pleasure to meet you. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Did you want to begin with your recitation of the book is on the table, Jim?
Well, no, because it's embarrassing. I took 4 years of French, and Marjorie mocks the fact that my knowledge is quite
limited.
Mine
is terrible. Mine is terrible, too. So I'm like, but Jim usually gives his little translation.
I'm not going to do it.
Right. And you can take classes at the Alliance Française. You
know, is that true?
Right. Wonderful classes.
There we go.
French classes.
So before we get to current events, just for people who don't know, what does it mean to be the Consul General? What do you do?
Well, the Consul General represents the French government here in Boston and for New England in general. And we try to promote partnerships between French institutions and U.S. institutions here. Obviously, the main focus in Boston is higher education and research, but you also have some very, very impressive innovation scene. And so we try to connect the ecosystems and multiply the occasions for exchanges between French institutions and U.S. institutions here.
In a few minutes, let's get back to what some of those exchanges are, if we can. But we've talked a lot about this yellow vest movement here, and I'm sure you've read the same things we have. You know, one newspaper says it's Russia-inspired. Another says it's an anti-COP24 thing. Another says it's a French version of America First. What is the yellow vest protest movement really about, in your estimation?
Well, actually, the movement started as a protest against a reform in gasoline taxation. So that was the core of the protest. But it gradually expanded and it aggregated some different claims. So the movement had different claims, but in a way, what we are seeing in France is what we are seeing in other countries, in Britain, for instance, with the Brexit movement, and in the U.S. to some extent. So it was a global movement, and I think the question behind it is the global question about equal opportunities for lower middle classes, equal expectations, social changes, automation, globalization. In this moving context, you know, what can we offer in terms of expectations and opportunities to lower middle classes? I think that was the core of the question raised by the movement.
Well, you know, I think when Americans look at France, they think of often jealously of a lot of the so-called welfare state things that we historically thought, you know, went on there, that you could retire at an earlier age and have a nice pension, that you could go to college for, you know, relatively and sometimes free and or not paying what you're paying over here. There was more schools going till 5 o'clock, people sitting around having a nice, relaxed dinner, you know, playing board games and stuff. And it sounds like, you know, from here, a lot of that is changing in a very dramatic way, and a whole way of life, it sounds like, is changing. Is that an ignorant American's view, or is that part of what's going on here that has got people so upset?
Well, definitely there are some social schemes that are very effective in France and produce very good results for the citizens, such as the health system in France is incredible. You know, the hospitals are have cutting-edge technology and at the same time are very affordable for French citizens. So I think French citizens want to keep these parts of the model that are working so well. And at the same time, other areas need reform. It is very clear the French government said that we will carry on reforms to cut public spending in some areas, to develop new activities, new services for the citizens. We will use the digital revolution also to reform, you know, public services. So I think this movement of reform is on. when you have reform, obviously you create changes, but people are quite optimistic about the changes. But again, it needs to be explained. So I think that's part of the global process of consultation that the president has just launched. We will see it in the coming months. It will be an important part of our national life.
Are the French people, after the fuel tax was rescinded as part of the reaction to the protests, is what was a pretty shaky relationship between President Macron and the people of France, is that better as a result of what happened in the last few weeks there? Is it more stable than it was?
Well, last week, President Macron delivered a very important speech. He made some big announcements, and this has changed the context. Definitely, the people could see that there is clear willingness on behalf of the government to listen to their concerns and to take the appropriate decisions. So now the focus is on bringing together all the stakeholders, finding the right solutions on the difficulties that have been identified. And it will be an interesting process, and people are very committed to it.
You know, speaking of right solutions, Marjorie and I were talking right before we went on the air about the New York Times front page story today about how Facebook yet again has let the people of the world down with violating privacy commitments to them, letting these tech giants in. France is about to become or has become the first EU nation to level a special tax on the tech giants. What happens in this country is when you want to raise taxes on huge businesses, they threaten to leave the country. They threaten to export jobs to another country. What's the reaction been, and why has France been able to do what most of the world has not been able to do, taking on the Googles and the Facebooks and those kinds of things?
Well, actually, France is not the only country that plans to tax the digital companies, U.S. companies, but European companies as well. You know, it's not directed against U.S. companies. The fact is that the taxation level of those companies is not enough, and that there is a clear willingness to make it more equal. So it's about their profits in France, in other countries. The characteristic of this industry is that the activities are not located in the same place as the consumers. So mm-hmm. it's how to bridge that gap, how to find the appropriate scheme to fairly and efficiently tax, not overtax, but just tax those activities.
By the way, we're speaking to the Consul General French Consul General in Boston, Arnaud Montreux. You know, I'm not going to embarrass myself by speaking French, even though Marjorie tried to get me to do it. But I will embarrass myself by saying I've now been looking at you for 8 minutes. Does everybody say you look exactly like Prime Minister Trudeau? Do you hear that every single day? You do. You know you do, right?
Well, it's maybe one of the signs of this strong relationship that exists between France and
Beautifully
Canada.
Beautifully put. Thank
That's
you very
right.
much.
That's right. But to get back to the Yellow Vests for a second, because one of the things that they were protesting about is the taxes to the wealthy and the taxes to companies. And, of course, that's what a lot of people, Democrats in the United States, weren't so happy about either, these massive tax cuts to big corporations and to wealthy people here. So why was that? Was that supposedly an economic stimulus? Is that why Macron took that path?
Well, that specific tax had consequences. Some people were leaving the country just to evade that tax. So the basic idea was to change that tax to make it a tax on land and real property and not on active capital that can be very profitable for companies and stimulate their growth. So that was the reform undertaken last year in 2017. And it had an effect, and it's a sign that things are moving in France, that people are more interested in companies, in developing companies, in innovation. And there's a very vibrant scene in France right now on these issues, on startups. You know, it's this revolution. People do not talk enough about it. But French students now, they want to become entrepreneurs, which is a French word, by the way. When I was a student 20 years ago, they wanted to become civil servants. So, which is for me a question, but it's a clear shift. in the aspiration of the young generation in France, and I think it's a very positive sign.
You know, the other thing I found fascinating when you're talking about the United States, which has been, even though we're having constant fights now about the President Trump and his really tough immigration policies, but we've basically been a nation of immigrants. You know, the British, the French, the Germans, the Italians, the people from South America, people from all around the world, basically. But this has not been true for the most part in Europe. And just a little I know about France, I mean, speaking the language is very important. Laïcité is something people talk about all the time. And there hasn't been this massive influx of people from other countries coming to the like there is now. So how does the government deal with that? We're much more used to that here than not just France, but Germany and Great Britain. It's different.
Well, France has a long history of migration. It's a country at the crossroads of Europe. Our culture is actually the result of different cultures, European cultures mixed together. And back in the 19th century, we had many Italian people settling in France or Belgian people settling in northeastern France, and they gradually integrated. It was not easy at some point. If we look back at our history, there were some tensions at some point, but they were fully integrated, and they are, that created a very strong French community. This history goes on, you know, people from Portugal, a large share of people from Portugal actually moved to France. And if you go today to Portugal, you will see many Portuguese people speaking French very well, and that's the sign of it. So we have this history. It's very important for our culture and for our history. The government tries to find the appropriate path for a perfect integration of migrants in the French society. And you referred to speaking the French language as something very important. It's true, it's a cultural factor, but it's also a basic need. If you want to integrate in a country, you need to speak the language. Otherwise, the possibilities of integration are much more limited. So that's one aspect of it. It's a policy that is very challenging, but the French government is working very hard on it.
Is it any different because people now are Muslims? There's this huge influx of Muslims and people from Africa in Paris. And I know I've read that that's been harder. Am I mistaken?
Well, back in the 60s and 70s, there were many people coming from Northern Africa to France. So again, it is not a new phenomenon. And I think the French model has proved pretty strong to integrate and develop this common spirit. The French people are very proud of their country, and they work very hard, and they are completely assimilated, and they back the country. So it's I don't think it's a new phenomenon. Obviously, when the number increases, it is more challenging. But again, it's not a completely new phenomenon.
Why do you think the French speak French better than the English, than the Americans speak English? You ever thought about that? I mean, we have a very difficult time with grammar and pronunciation here in the United States, speaking our own language of English. And it seems
I don't think that's the important quote. Remember what Barack Obama said when he was campaigning?
Yeah, he said between you and me.
No. When Barack Obama, I think I'm not sure if he was president yet, but he took a lot of heat for this, but I totally agree with him. He talked about how the world is bi and trilingual, as you obviously are. And speaking to the consul general, and he says, in this country, if you can say merci beaucoup, you think you're violent. I mean, that's really the issue, is it not, that the rest of the world thinks it's important to speak the languages other than your home language? In this country, we do not. I mean, isn't that?
No, we don't, but we don't speak English very well.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know if that's. So one last thing that I bet you're not going to want to get into, because you are a diplomat, and that'll be fine. This country, people were really upset on the 100th anniversary of World War I when our president went to France, and because of the rain, didn't go to the cemetery. He didn't go to the Arlington Cemetery for Veterans Day a few days later. How did the French react to this thing?
Well, I think that was a completely American question. And actually, the French press did not cover that much these kind of events. And because the focus was more on all those leaders gathered together in Paris, you had the German chancellor and the French president hand in hand celebrate the 100th anniversary of a disaster that took place. And Germany and France were the main protagonists of it. And France was actually aggressed by the German troops at that time. So the reconciliation process in Europe is extremely important, and that symbol focused the attention more than what happened for each delegation.
Very diplomatic of you, I should say. Now, Consul General, can we come back to the United States? You mentioned when Marjorie asked you about what the primary function of the Consul General here is, trying to promote these exchanges, particularly academic. Give us a couple of examples of those French-American connections that have been facilitated by you and your predecessors, those kinds of things.
Well, one example is this joint workshop that that took place at MIT 1 month ago between MIT students and researchers and French students and researchers coming on green materials. Those researchers work on new types of cement that can isolate houses and make it more energy efficient. So that's a very concrete example. Those are solutions that would be good for humankind, actually, but it's French researchers and MIT researchers, American researchers, working on it. That's one example. We have a series of examples like that. French philosophers, intellectuals, researchers, scientists have been coming to Cambridge for a long time and to other institutions in the Boston area. The exchanges are very vivid. We had a seminar 2 months ago about artificial intelligence and how we need an interdisciplinary approach of artificial intelligence to grasp, to fully benefit from the opportunities of artificial intelligence, but also to take into consideration the possible side effects.
Tell us about higher education in France. If you're a good high school student and you want to go to college, how much it costs and what your options are?
Well, it's a very different system. It's not at all the way you do it here in America. Higher education is considered as a sort of public good. It means that the community actually pays for the studies of the students in France. That's particularly true for universities. You know, the tuition fees are extremely low for French universities. But the reality is that it's the French state that pays for the studies of the students there. We also have what we call grandes écoles, the high schools, the colleges, specific colleges. There are two types of it, business schools and engineering schools. And in France, we've got this long tradition of engineering schools. It's really part of the French DNA, the DNA of the French higher education system. You know, we have engineering school is the backbone of the system, and they work quite well.
So, and that people want to keep that. Those are very popular.
Actually, people want to keep that,
yeah.
Yes. We think it's important to have affordable education.
Imagine that.
And it's...
No.
It is part, actually, of the equal opportunities I was referring to before, and it's a very important aspect of our system.
We're talking to Arnaud Montré. He's the Consul General from France to Boston. So you mentioned a couple of minutes ago, Consul General, that French intellectuals, French academics come, but much more importantly, French chefs come to America. So how long have you been in Boston? How long have you been working here?
Only 2 months.
Okay, that's plenty. What are the best French restaurants in Boston?
I guess the French chef is the chef at the French residence, I would say.
What are the best restaurants in town, in your estimation? What do we get right here?
He's only been here 2 months.
I don't care. I care about cuisine.
Putting him on the spot now.
A Frenchman.
He's a diplomat. You can't tell. He's not supposed to.
It's a very hard question for me because it's a network. You know, French people are very close. Here in Boston, there's a vibrant French community, and it's difficult for me to say this restaurant is better than the other.
Is there a vibrant French community
Boston? There is indeed. We have 10,000 French people registered at the consulate, and so we assess that it's, roughly speaking, 20,000 French people living here in the Boston area.
And they have a great Bastille Day party every year, too, which is a big hit.
We have a great Bastille Day.
Yes.
One is organized by the French Cultural Center, and it's a popular event as far as I know. And we also have a series of events on that occasion.
And we're going to give you the website, by the way, in a couple of minutes for the consul. You were in Moscow for a couple of years. Is that true, earlier in your diplomatic career?
Yes, I was posted in Moscow and in New Delhi.
When you read the things you read about now, vis-a-vis American elections and the Russians, does any of that surprise you?
The same question arose for the Yellow Vest movement in France. You know, there were media reports saying that there was Russian intervention on this. And our Minister for Foreign Affairs, Jean-Yves Le Drian, actually said that an investigation would be carried out. So pending the result of that investigation, it's hard for me to say, you know, to assess or to say anything about this aspect of things. It's a concern. You know, the French authorities said very clearly that any Russian intervention in democratic processes would be taken very seriously. So the concern is there. But again, for facts, we need the results of that investigation.
Were you worried? We've had many congresspeople here, members of Congress, senators here, who have traveled to Moscow in recent years, and they talk about how they know that everything they're doing is being monitored. Is that a concern when you're a diplomat stationed in Russia as well?
Well, again, I was posted in Moscow quite a long time ago. It was between 2009 and 2011, so it was a different period. So I can't really speak for today. You know, I don't know what the situation in Moscow is right now.
You have to behave yourself.
What do you mean?
When you're in Moscow, because they're watching you every second.
They are? We have to behave yourself here because Facebook is watching you every second. So you have to. So before you go, are you enjoying? You've only been here a couple of months. I think you told me you'd been to Boston one time before. What are your initial impressions of your station here?
Well, I enjoy it very much. I think it's a great city. I'm impressed by the progress achieved by the city for 20 years. You know, I think it's the result. I'm told it's the result of a long-standing and wise policy. The tech scene here is astounding. The French the biotech industry is flourishing, and I think it's very positive for the city. So for me now, one objective is to connect the French ecosystem with the Bostonian ecosystem. The French companies actually participate in this dynamism in Boston very much. Sanofi Genzyme is the first employer of the state in the bio field. Dassault System 3DS is extremely active there. They have their headquarters here in Boston. Saint-Gobain has been present for a long time. So French companies really participate in the development of the city, and we'd like to use those bridges, those existing bridges, to further connect the two ecosystems.
It's great to meet you. Welcome to Boston. We hope to see you again soon. We really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. That was the voice of Arnaud Montré. He's Boston's Consul General. To learn about the French consulate in Boston, you go to boston.consulgeneral.org. Thank you also very much for coming in. Up next, the face of retail is changing along the way we shop. How does the Santa Mall change with the times? Harvard historian Nancy Gain joins us for the plight of the Santa Mall next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. This is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're going to take a look at Santa's other workshop, the shopping mall. With consumer habits changing and malls going belly up around the country, what does it mean for the mall Santa workforce? And how is the Mall Santa adapting? Joining us to put the Mall Santa in the context of retail history is Harvard historian Nancy Gain. Nancy holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration at the Harvard Business School. Her latest book is Forging Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Hello there and happy Christmas, Nancy Gain.
Happy Christmas, ho, ho, ho.
To you too.
Apparently, at least according to the Wall Street Journal, with its pulse on the business climate of America, the poor, sad Santa is confronting empty malls and left to wonder if he has something offensive in his beard, or perhaps he has bad breath, right, or that he's too scary for the kids, or things are tough.
So let's lead with the economic driver. Mall vacancies are at a 7-year high as of this third quarter. So no one's in malls, or fewer people are in malls. So that means fewer kids lining up, fewer parents lining up behind their children to sit to sit and talk to Santa. And it's, you know, it's a market change over the last couple of years. It's been happening for a while, but it's a market change. So Santa's, so it turns out, this is what I learned reading these many stories, dear listeners, about the business of being Santa. It's a business, and there are schools to become Santas.
Mm-hmm.
There are the required items and clothing, and in some cases, if you're going to join, I believe, the International Brotherhood of Real Bearded Santas, the IBRBS Society or group, you have to have a real beard, the beard growing techniques, the bleaching techniques, et cetera. It is a profession for people part-time during the year, and people, they are adapting, right? There are Santas that specialize in having selfies. Right. Come get a selfie with Santa. Very short. It's a different experience than many of us and many of our listeners knew as a kid, where you waited in line. Mom took pictures, eventually got to sit on Kris Kringle's lap and talk about what you wanted for Christmas. But there are now Santa's selfies. There are Santas that are putting them on their own websites with their workshops in the background. And then I'm not sure how they're making money on that. A lot of the Santas that are call themselves premier or professional Santas, people who have been doing this year after year, who've been trained, who may even teach in Santa schools. A lot of these people are really putting a heavy emphasis on trying to do work at corporate functions, right? There are Santas at the Atlanta Braves and Falcons. They have their own Santa. There are all kinds of different places, corporate parties, private parties, charitable functions that need Santa's jolly and benevolent presence. So we're adapting as best we can, but the bottom line is a lot of Santas in malls right now have time on their hands in a way that they never did, because when did you ever go to see a Santa that didn't have a line?
Well, the only place I ever did was a mall that has since gone out of business, which is the Atrium Mall that used to be on Route 9.
That was a beautiful mall.
And I remember going in there with my kids when they were little, which is going back a ways now, and there was never anybody in there, which I guess.
Well, the whole Atrium Mall was always. That's why I went out of business. There was never anybody there.
There was never anybody there.
That was a luxury mall, luxury brands.
Yeah.
It was luxury.
Yeah, they had a Barney's in there for a while, which is really expensive. Crate and Barrel, Pottery Barn. But it was a beautiful mall. So I was always kind of surprised that there was never anyone in there.
Well, that's really sad, Marjorie. Now, before we continue with the Santa thing, which I'm actually interested in,
because
you never think about the collateral damage from lots of things.
Right.
We know that malls,
no.
But the first indoor mall in the country was where, Marjorie? Again, I've told you this 500 times. Go, where was it?
It was next to where you grew up in Philadelphia.
Well, it's close. And what's the significance of it in my life?
That you went there and sat on Santa Claus's lap.
No, I did not. My senior prom was at the
Cherry Hill
Mall.
I think she just emailed us.
She's in France, by the way. Speaking of the French consul
maybe
general,
she's made a trip home.
I think the Cherry Hill Mall dates all the way back to the late 1950s.
Right? Does it really?
I'm pretty sure it's like 1957, 58.
It was the first mall.
Yeah, so quite a long time ago.
But what I'm interested in, before we get back to Santa, because that's all Marjorie really cares about, is mall Santas. Why are malls done? Is this an internet thing? I mean, malls, you do go to malls. By the way, I'm occasionally in a mall where, other than the Apple store, there are like three people in a mall with 40 stores. So is that about the internet?
It's about two things. It's the first and most important, I think, economic driver is the migration of shopping from bricks and mortar retailing to e-commerce, to the internet. That's a huge driver. But the second driver, we don't want to forget this, because this it transcends or precedes the electronic commerce, is America has been massively overstored for about 10 to 12 years, about 20 years, actually. And this is a historical kind of roller coaster that the country rides, that we build a lot of stores and then they contract because we have too many. They go out of business, Schumpeter's, creative destruction takes hold, and then we get back to a kind of a reasonable number of stores per person, per square foot, per consuming dollar. And we're still overstuffed, to use a Christmas metaphor, we're still overstuffed with stores. So some of this is not just about all of us shopping online. It's about, if you will, more fundamental drivers. But both things are going on, and mall traffic is declining. I was in New York last week, and I noticed all along Madison Avenue there was empty retail space. I couldn't believe it. That used to be considered Madison Avenue, a little bit like the Miracle Mile in Chicago, some of the best real estate and retail real estate in the world. So the malls are not the only venues, if you will, suffering from from changes in shopping behavior and from too many stores. But that is definitely what's happening to Santa. He's in a place where people are not, or not in such large numbers. And he's a little bit lonely, and he has time on his hands.
I don't want to, you know, I realize I'm veering way off base here because, again, Marjorie's obsessed with the mall Santa issue, which is beyond me. But
always,
okay, it's fine.
I always thought.
Did you see? I didn't read a story that, I'm sorry, just finish this one thought and then we can get back to Santa. There was a story that I did not read except the headline the other day, and I meant to, and I printed it out, and I have no idea where it is now. I just Google it, about what Amazon is going to do to downtown areas. I mean, a same-day delivery of Amazon, what it's going to do, because even that instant gratification thing, you don't need to go to a brick-and-mortar kind of thing. So, you know,
and now your groceries will come to you from Amazon, too.
Exactly.
Right?
So malls are closing downtown. I mean, in Cambridge, where I live, you go where you work, you see lots of what used to be pack shopping areas where they're vacant storefronts. I mean, is it ridiculous to think that we're 10 years away from almost not literally, but approaching a store-free environment?
No, because again, it's a historian time for the historical droplet here is, or the historical sidebar. Different forces have been doing this to downtowns for a long time. So the shopping mall back in the 1950s and 1960s emptied out downtowns all over the country, and a lot of them came from Baltimore. The most famous, you know, the Baltimore waterfront came roaring back. So, you know, capitalism keeps generating different kinds of, you know, if you will, losers, and then new winners that grow into their, like hermit crabs grow into those spaces. So I was just walking along Mount Auburn this morning on my way to do some television work, and I noticed that in about three storefronts in Harvard Square where there were stores to buy things, like books in one case, there are now there's a bakery and another like small restaurant. And so what we're going to see a lot more, I think, service and experiential outlets in lots of those places, but we're not going to get ghost towns in downtowns provided there's the surrounding economy to support commerce, and there will be certainly in the case of Cambridge.
So returning to mall Santa, one of the things I learned, you mentioned the cost, that these guys, and I assume they're virtually all guys, I assume there's some women, $1,000 to buy the crap that you got to wear.
At least.
Then
they
cleaning expenses and those sort of things, which are regular. So is this a profitable venture for the average?
Well, this I thought this was really interesting. So again, who knew that being a Santa was a business, right? Both for individuals and for groups. So the average Santa during Christmas, this is someone who's professionally trained and doing it and is established. And in many cases, for mall Santas, these people are vetted. They have background checks.
Thank goodness.
So.
Many of them
exactly.
go through an effectively Santa employment agency. Mm-hmm. So it's not like anyone can walk in to say, you know, Burlington Mall and say,
now,
I want to be your Santa, right? Many of them carry liability insurance. They make an average of about $40 an hour. Now, the ones that have been doing this a long time, particularly the ones that have access to higher priced or higher paid corporate private functions, even retirement parties, Christmas parties for an individual, higher Santas, those people can make as much, hold your breath, dear listeners, as much as $25,000 to $35,000 in the 6 weeks of Christmas, which go from basically Black Friday to Christmas. $35,000. So a lot of people will get into it. And then these articles, many of which are very great pains, I'll give you one example of them, dear listeners. The elite cabal of mall Santas making up to and over $20,000 every Christmas season. This is from November 28th, 2018, Vox, a column called The Goods. You can get it online. So as the premier Santas will tell you, right, you have to establish a certain reputation. We have mastered all the lingo. We have mastered how to keep our beards clean. All these, we have mastered how to not have our backs go out picking up and putting down children all day. All these finer points of being a Santa, right? If you're an elite premier Santa, you are making a good living, but you didn't get there on day one. You've had a lot of experience and mileage to do that.
Didn't we used to have almost every year
we stopped.
We used to invite two guys in who did Santa, who had real beards, who were part
of
the
profession. Where was this? Was this at your former radio station?
No,
I think
we did it here too.
They were very, very impressive guys who had.
They were really into it.
They were really into it. Yeah.
So here's one of the things that struck me reading these articles, and these are most of these articles, dear listeners. And I'll give you another one: how much money it costs to be Santa Claus and how much you can make. This is from, bear with me, Make It. It's an NBC News website, and it's from basically today. It's from really recently. Anyway, all of these people that do this, including Rick Rosenthal, who runs Northern Lights Santa Academy and is a well-known, very well-known, premier well-known Santa. And he's, by the way, an Orthodox Jew who discovered he wanted to be a Santa one day when a boy came up to him in a store when he was young and said, "Oh, Santa." And he was so struck by how good it felt to see the child's reaction. He said, "I'm going to become a Santa." And he has become, you know, a teacher and a kind of leading light, if you will, in the Santa Claus world. But how much these people get out of it emotionally. There's one man who said, you know, "I've seen everything. I've seen kids cry about, you know, with disappointment. I've seen kids giggle with joy. I've seen, because Santas are in hospitals, my friends. I've seen folks that are on they're literally dying and how much joy a moment with Santa Claus brings them. I've seen, you know, families with sick children. I've seen the gamut, and being a Santa and being able to bring what Santa represents into people's lives makes the whole thing worthwhile. As good as the money can be, it's much more for me about the emotions. And they all talk about that sense of satisfaction they get.
Well, we just got an email from Mike who says he's a personalized Santa. He goes to family holiday parties and gatherings. He sent me a whole bunch of pictures. He said he doesn't have a real beard, but for less than $100 an hour, he'll give you an hour of personal one-on-one time with the big guy. He reads stories, leads the kids in songs, plays games, mingles with the parents, and as he said, does.
How long has he been
Santa.
Out on parole? Does he say that in that?
he doesn't look very suspicious to me.
He
looks, no, he looks quite official.
You know, by the way, there's certain things. You know, I'm thinking about. He was a great Santa. I don't even know who the guy is. You and I are doing the night before Christmas with the Boston Pops
at the
Friday
Boston
night.
Pops, yes.
At the end, I don't think we're giving
anything
away.
But they have a good
away.
Santa.
Keith Lockhart does a back and forth with a Santa. I don't know if it's the same guy every year.
Yeah.
He's
good.
Great.
That's
whoever
a good question.
He is. He is
I wonder
funny,
that,
and he does a really good thing with Keith. They have a good little shtick kind of thing going there, and so there are excellent ones. Why are you so absorbed in this?
Well, I was
thing
just
here?
Looking at the. He's not. You don't look, Mike. You don't look heavy enough to be.
No,
but they
padding,
wear padding,
Marjorie.
Right? Because they don't want to encourage people
Santa
to be unhealthy.
He doesn't
look. Maybe I'm looking
really?
In the wrong
well,
angle.
Well, there's a.
You
whole,
need a hefty Santa.
You need a hefty Santa,
don't
and padding.
Thin,
and padding costs you money, but lots of them use padding. We should tell our listeners that there's a wonderful story in here about Larry Jefferson, who was the first African American Santa at the Mall of America. And he
that's in Minnesota.
I'm sorry, that's the biggest mall in the country, dear listeners. Many of us are new. Most many of our listeners are too young to remember when it opened, but it has millions of square feet and it's a city unto itself.
What are they going to do without the Mall
of America?
And
I would wonder what the traffic is like.
Yeah. You
know,
wait, is it closing?
No, but it will sooner or later.
Well, I know. I just wonder what utilization rates are because there's a lot of floor space to fill there. But in any event, Larry Jefferson, who lives in Texas, comes up north every year. Recently, he's actually just started doing this, comes up to be an African-American Santa and says the reaction has just been overall in person extraordinarily positive. There were a lot, he said, though, when he began, a lot of racist comments posted on I believe the mall's website. But he said in person, all Americans of all shapes and sizes, colors, backgrounds have just been embracing and very delighted. And then they quote a white woman saying, "I really wanted my kids to see Santa in the many different forms that we all are. And here's a wonderful, wonderful man."
By the way,
and he's
you
a black
know,
Santa.
I'm sure you read the story. Megyn Kelly was boycotting that Santa.
That's
do you know
right.
that?
Megyn now, Kelly. She said Santa Claus.
You're
had
making
to be,
that up.
I
no.
believe I am.
She
no,
said
I'm
Santa
not
Claus
making up that she's
had
got
to
a
be
problem.
White.
That she
yeah,
did.
She said,
you know,
get used to it.
You know, we're forgetting we're talking about malls. What is our favorite mall story in the 19 years we've been on the radio, Marjorie? I'll give you a little hint. His parents bought him a condo.
Oh, out at the Natick Collection.
Or whatever it's called.
They opened this very fancy addition to the Natick Mall that you walk through this forest of pine trees and stuff like that. And they had these condos next to the mall, on top of the mall.
On top of the mall, yeah.
So that you could come down to the first, just start your shopping day right in your home, as it were. And the parents, who were elderly, they bought their son,
their 40-something son,
a condo in the Natick Collection
Mall complex.
Why'd they do that? Right down the hall from theirs. Well, because they had a meet and greet bar with a happy hour every day, and they thought perhaps
he'd meet somebody.
He'd find a.
It was in the Boston Globe. It is worth searching. It's about 10 years ago, and it's a fabulous story.
Okay, well,
I'm sorry to answer
P.S. One of the things, so that reminds me that one of the things that some of the enterprising Santas who aren't getting the traffic they want at the malls are doing is working as bartenders and working as greeters in lots of different kinds of service establishments as a way of making their Santa living.
Chelsea Merce took me back to the history books in this in preparing this. Chelsea Merce, a superstar producer of the show, took me back to the history books. So who was the first Santa? So the first department store Santa, and there's a little bit of contention, I might add, dear listeners, was a gentleman from Brockton, Massachusetts.
Wow.
Named
James Edgar, who was a dry goods merchant.
Wow.
And he got this idea back in
I believe it's 1890.
1890, and he took the train into Boston, bought himself a Santa suit that he had made, was not, you know, he didn't go to a rent-a-costume shop, bought himself a Santa suit.
Well, it's hard if he's the first one to get a rent-a-costume
Santa
thing,
and,
you know what I
mean? And he shows up in his store, and the reaction of the children was so amazing. That became a tradition in the store, dry goods stores, which were the predecessors of department stores or the forerunners of department stores. And then other department stores took it up. The only reason I said at the top of these remarks was that there's contention is that Macy's,
with the famous Miracle on 34th
Street. Macy's wants to claim the first to do this. But it's not clear that their Macy's was, that their Santa, their Kris Kringle, how he was known, was in fact really, according to the Bostonian historians holding up the flag for James Edgar and Brockton, was really a Santa, and the reaction of all the folks in Boston is, I don't think it quite cut it. But in any event, by 1920, department stores and then later shopping malls and all kinds of retail establishments would be clamoring for and hiring Santas because this had become an institution. So
it
goes all the way back 120 years.
I don't know if I'm supposed to do this, but I figure it's a holiday spirit. What I do on the side when I'm not doing the radio, Marjorie knows this, probably the only one, I rent myself out as an elf. So if there are private parties or bar mitzvahs or other things like
you
that,
where you could use a really large
elf.
Shoes. Yes,
right.
He's got
they
the
little
elf
curl
shoes
up in the front.
Today.
Yeah, exactly.
So I will say that one of the things I learned is, apropos of elves is that the really good Santas have to do a lot of studying before they can sit down, where they have to know the names of elves, they have to know the reindeer, they have to know distance,
absolutely,
and they have to know hot toys. They have to know what are the hot toys this year. That's quite an undertaking because they change all the time. Right, and they're very different from often than the ones we used. Mm-hmm. Although I was happy to learn this year that easy bake ovens are still requested, and many boys are requesting easy bake ovens, and young girls are requesting tool sets. So the world is changing, and Santa's right there at the center.
It's a beautiful place to call it quits.
Nancy, thank you.
Everything
thank
you wanted
very
to know
much.
About a mall Santa and more. Thank you.
Don't you think Jim
Nancy.
Would make a cute elf?
Really cute elf.
Don't knock it till you've seen it, my friend.
Yeah, happy Christmas and to all a good night.
Right, see you, Nancy.
Harvard historian
so
Nancy
much.
Kane joins us every week. She holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. Her latest book, Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Nancy, thank you very much. Merry Christmas. Coming up, it's a nation in the making. WGBH executive arts editor Jared Bowen joins us to talk about a revival of the musical 1776. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie. And here with us in Studio 3 with a rundown of the latest arts and culture events in and around town is GBH's executive arts editor, Jared Bowen. Jared's also the host of the TV series Open Studio, which you can catch Friday nights at 8:30 right here on GBH2. Hello there, Jared.
Hello.
Hello, Jared Bowen. Before we talk about 1776 and all the other stuff that you've arranged for us, tell us about Penny Marshall, who just died. She was a big cultural figure for many Americans, no?
I think for a lot of Americans. I'm realizing over the last 24 hours since we learned of her death that I think especially people of my generation, because we would go home from school every day and watch Laverne and Shirley. So
exactly.
It was a fundamental part of my childhood. And then
I never saw it once, by the way.
No.
And
really?
By the way, it's not a choice. It was that kind of thing that didn't interest me, but everybody loved it. Who saw it?
Of course.
You did love it?
I absolutely loved it. It was so much fun. And then she made some of the most formative movies of my childhood, too, in big and A League of Their Own.
Oh, that's
League
right.
Of Their Own is great.
That's right.
Well, you know, I was just reading today too that that may stand as one of the most as the most successful in terms of box office baseball movie of all
really?
Time.
More
Tom
than
Hanks?
Bull Durham?
Yes.
That, really?
The,
Madonna?
The full list in Field of Dreams, maybe
oh,
in terms
Field
of immediate
Dreams,
box
too.
Office, but it certainly stands up there. But I mean, you really think about who she was, and she was really funny too, and I think that's why I've always been so fond of her. She was just this incredible personality, always very self-deprecating and grounded and down to earth, because I didn't realize that she had essentially come from a family of entertainers. Her father made industry films, and of course her brother was Gary Marshall.
Princess Bride, wasn't he? Princess? I think he directed Princess.
Her
ex-husband.
Oh, thank you, yeah. John Parker, for Clara. I knew it was somebody in the family.
John knows everything.
He does know everything.
So she grew up. I mean, this was her whole life, but she always managed to keep herself grounded. And I always remember Rosie O'Donnell talking about her in these absolutely reverential terms, but also just hilarious about what communicating with Betty Marshall was like with that voice of hers.
How many major women directors were there when she had triumphs with Tom Hanks and
major women directors?
I mean, not many, right?
No,
I mean, that
no.
was pretty big deal.
I think maybe you had Barbara Streisand making movies around the same time, but yeah, you'd be hard pressed to name any other. And then she was the first woman to have a film gross over $100 million.
I didn't know that either.
The first woman to have a film gross $100 million, and of course was big. But she just she left a pretty incredible path, and everybody just had such nice things to say about her. It made me really sad, I have to say.
Yeah, because she wasn't that old. She's in her 70s, which isn't young, but that's not that old. I think everybody should make it to at least 80 these days.
You do?
I do.
Was that your rule of thumb?
Well, I just think, you know, that's a good long
I used
life.
To think 80. Now I think like 95 would be, give or take. I don't know why I've changed my mind, but 95, 96
okay.
seems to be
all right.
just about
okay,
right.
Well, you got good genes, Jim.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So let's move on to 1776, this new play. What
it's
is,
not a new play. I saw it, I think, on Broadway about 80 years ago or something.
Okay.
I mean, it was
it's a new play
wasn't
here.
Wasn't it like a Tony award-winning Broadway thing?
It was back in 1969.
Maybe I didn't see it on Broadway then because I wasn't in New York yet. I thought I did, but go ahead. What's the
deal?
Well,
the timing here is interesting because 1969, this musical premiered just during the Nixon presidency. Mm-hmm. And so you look at the time that New Repertory is now restaging it, and it's there at New Rep in Watertown through December 30th. But this, of course, takes us back to our founding fathers. As the program says, you have these anti-establishment, rebellious spirit of the founding fathers who are all gathered in this very hot summer of 1776 to debate taxes and property, sedition. But New Rep has changed up. I will say two things about this. One, I don't think that the musical holds up very well, especially in the age of Hamilton.
Well,
yeah.
That's pretty tough to come back
it's very
with this
tough.
Kind of thing
yeah.
after Hamilton. Yeah.
And you consider, 50 years ago, there was a very different style of musical making. So there are long stretches where you're just hearing the book here, and there's a lot of debate. It's a little sluggish in its movement. However, what I really appreciated about it is what New Repertory Theater has done, and it's essentially color and gender blind casting. So you have men playing women, women playing men. The founding fathers are played by people of color. So I think that when some of the things are espousing, especially around race and the slavery issue, having them come out of the actors of the coming out of the mouths of actors of color has even more resonance. And also what they've done, this is directed by Austin Pendleton, well-known character actor and now a theater guy, and Kelly Edwards. They have assembled a really terrific cast here.
Oh, actually, we have a little music. Can we do this?
Sure.
Piddle, Twiddle, and Resolve. Is that a song in the thing? I guess it is. Here is a little bit of this from 1776.
Good God, for one solid year. Been sitting here for 1 year doing nothing. I do believe you've laid a curse on North America, a curse that we here now rehearse in Philadelphia. A second flood, a simple famine, plagues of locusts everywhere, or a cataclysm.
It's a very appropriate time, just like 1969, to be reacquainted with how this country came to be and the debates that we had and how this country got up on its feet. By the way, not before almost coming apart, before it even came together. So it's interesting to see all of those notions reintroduced here. And As I said, I just love the casting. Really strong voices.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. I remember when I went and saw Hamilton, and I got to see it twice, which was a huge thrill. You just think there are certain productions that come along seemed to change everything. I mean, I would guess this was true a million years ago.
West Side Story.
West Side Story, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Where it just opened up a whole new frontier. And then for a while after that, everything else kind of seems
dated, or something. Well, it does change the tone. It does seem to be generational. I actually just finished reading the book Something Wonderful by Todd Purdom, which is about Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Oh, that was supposed to be a great book.
It's a terrific book. And do you know how groundbreaking Oklahoma was?
Huge. Usually, they thought, well, that is a great musical, too. But they talked about that in that book, how it just sort of changed everything in a similar way.
Well, before, everything had to be really stagey and really dramatic, and you have big, fun musical numbers, and that's how you'd start your show. But then Oklahoma started, by the way, and it started Away We Will Go here, right here at the Colonial Theater before going to New York. Away We Go, I think. And the reason it was groundbreaking was because it was so naturalistic. It didn't start the way other musicals had started. It didn't go into territory that other musicals had. People didn't have high expectations for it. And then it opened and it became absolutely magnificent and huge. And then they did the same thing with South Pacific and The King and I, and really kind of keyed into post-World War II America and what the nation was feeling. And reading this book, you understand that Hamilton was not alone in terms of people dying to get tickets, do anything to get tickets, because Rodgers and Hammerstein did it with a succession of their shows.
Do you know, I've read the review of the book. That's what I often do. I end up reading the reviews instead of the book itself. But I think I recall, and maybe you recall this, it was originally Rodgers and Hart. Right?
Right.
What happened? Do you remember?
Well, Hart had a lot of issues. And so, I mean, they had a lot of success, but Hart, with his personal demons that he struggled with, Rodgers eventually had to move on. And then there was just something about Rodgers and Hammerstein coming together that they really brought the best out in each other. But it's fascinating because they didn't necessarily knew they were doing that, because one didn't know how the other felt about them till the day they died. It's really, really extraordinary, because they didn't – people probably picture them sitting in the same room, in the same living room over a piano. That's not how they worked.
They worked separately.
They worked separately, and they would meet often. But, yeah, they weren't quite sure of how the other felt about each other.
By the way, before Rodgers and Hart, Tim Glidden wrote, it was Rodgers and Astaire they were. So that was
But that sounds like a
Thank
wonderful
you,
book.
Jared, I appreciate
one other little piece of trivia. Do you know? So there was this little boy named Stevie who was down the road from Hammerstein's farm, who would just come by often because he didn't have the best childhood growing up. Little Stevie was Stephen Sondheim.
Oh well, wow. Oh, that's a great little thing.
And Stephen Sondheim has often said, "If I lived down the street from a great geologist, I probably would have been a geologist."
That is great.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
By the way, it's at the Mosesian Center for the Arts. I don't know if you said this, in Wartown through December 30th.
Okay, how about this new thing at the ART, this barbershop, all
Chronicles.
About men at the barbershop. But yeah, the Barbershop Chronicles. This sounds like it's got great.
Yeah, this is
stuff.
A sprawling piece. You have about 30 characters played by 12 different actors. This is playing at the American Repertory Theater through January 5th. It's come from London. And Barbershop Chronicles finds African men in barbershops all across the world. And we see these scenes swap in and out with one another. But we see barbershops in England, South Africa, Zimbabwe, Uganda, Nigeria, Ghana. And barbershops for these men are really the sole place where they can gather and they can have true conversations where they don't necessarily have to feel filtered or essentially they can be raw and fresh. And in this play, we see them discussing everything from generational divides to the use of slurs, relationships, careers, finances, even geopolitics. And so over the course of this two-hour show, we dive in and out of these barbershops with kind of a succession of narrative that I don't believe completely builds in a way that's absolutely captivating. However, to see what they present and to hear these stories by these terrific actors is pretty remarkable, as are the transitions, I have to say, how they move from one barbershop to the next.
You know, just in life, it's interesting how many times you go by past a barbershop and you see all these guys standing around that have either had their hair cut already or they're just hanging around. You don't see that in women's hair salons. I think it's because of the blow dryers making too much noise.
I know. You always pass by those barbershops and you go, what are they talking about?
Yes.
I always think, for some reason, you don't think of men necessarily being especially talkative. Maybe it's the household in which I grew up. But I always pass by, you know, men on the road or something. I'm thinking, what are they talking about when they have their cell phone up?
Yeah. I lived on the corner there was one on the corner from where I used to live for a while, and it was packed all the time. And there was only one barber in there. And they weren't all waiting in line to get their haircut. They were just there.
Well, that's interesting, too, I noticed about this play, is just how they're literally positioned that some are engaging, some are presiding in the barbershop, and just that the power dynamic in terms of what is being expressed and who you are in the barbershop shifts.
We're talking to Jared Bowen. We're talking about the theater for the moment. Breath and imagination. The star is a big shot, yes?
He is an amazing voice. His name is Davern Monroe, and he is playing Roland Hayes, who, I should mention, this is presented by Lyric Stage Company, and it's playing through December 23rd. It's also a co-production with Front Porch Arts Collective, which is a new theater in town. In their words, it's a new black and brown-led theater company to bring the stories of other people of color to the stage, more so than they already are. And Breath and Imagination finds Roland Hayes, who is the first world-renowned African-American classical vocalist, among the first, really rising up from parents who had been enslaved in a Georgia plantation, and his mother wants him, she recognizes that he has a great voice, this is a true story, wants him to sing spirituals, but then suddenly one day he hears the tenor Enrico Caruso on a record and decides this is what his path is going to be, and he does it. He gets this amazing classical formal training and ultimately becomes one of the most sought-after voices in this country, sold-out concerts right here at Symphony Hall, ultimately settled in the Boston area, Brookline, I believe, Marjorie, and ultimately performs for kings and queens, but at the same time that there is such rampant racism and segregation in the United States, and that becomes the framework for this piece, is that he is giving this benefit concert at a time in which his wife and daughter have been arrested for being in the whites-only section of a shoe store.
You know, I have never seen him perform. I'm looking through his resume here, but I've heard only unbelievable things about it. Is he like a local legend, or is he has stretched his proverbial wings beyond our borders? What's his deal?
You mean in terms of Roland Hayes or the...
No, Monroe I'm talking about.
I've seen him in any number of productions here, and he clearly you see that he gets to exercise his classical chops. But I think he has traveled a fair amount, but I believe, I'm not completely sure, but because based on the number of pieces I've seen him do in Boston, I believe he's one of our own, yeah.
Talking to Jared Bowen.
Okay, what's the deal with A Story Beyond, A Musical Fable? You reviewed that.
And I will say, that I don't say this very often, but if there's one show that you really... Wow. We've just talked about a number of great shows, but if there's one show you really must see, it's A Story Beyond.
Why?
It's this tiny little piece, and it's playing at... it's presented by Liars and Believers at the Plaza Black Box Theater at the Boston Center for the Arts just through December 22nd. I thought this was just so wonderfully done. This company, Liars and Believers, spent 2 years crafting this piece, and here you find this young girl, Maya. She's fierce and strong and undaunted, and she's living in this village. The village is clouded over by this cloud that is pervading the people. So everybody has turned kind of leaden. There's a darkness that has consumed them. This is obviously a piece that you can draw parallels to our own time. But in this piece, with music and projections and puppetry, we see the adventures of this little girl. She's determined to figure out why this cloud is so pervasive, and she's going to counter it. And the way it's told is just so different, and it's fresh. It reminds me of Julie Taymor and even Ryan Landry, to some degree, doing so much with so little. But in the end, a way that is so emotionally resonant and poignant. It's great for kids. I think on an intellectual level, it's perfect for adults. On a soothing level for adults, it's perfect to see. I was just so struck. This is the first production of theirs that I've seen. I was just so struck by what they did. And one of the final scenes where this little girl, again, rendered by a puppet, is climbing a mountain. Just how they move boxes so that you get this epic cinematic sense of how she's climbing was staggering.
Is it a puppet show or is it a mix?
It's a mix.
Okay.
And they I believe the creator, the founders of this company have studied puppetry in Italy. So they bring a lot of great storytelling, theatrical telling methods to this piece.
By the way, the whole BPR team for our Christmas thing is going, speaking of Ryan Landry, going to A Nightmare on Elm Street on Thursday night. How excited are you about that? I'm very excited.
It's going to be great. He's an unbelievably talented guy. But, you know, a lot of us stopped going to puppet shows when we were little or bring nephews and nieces or kids to puppet shows. But I remember going to ones in Brookline, at that puppet theater in Brookline. Good puppetry is amazing. It's just amazing.
And this isn't, I think, if you have a conception of what puppetry was like when you were a kid and you're just this little tiny panoramic stage and you see the puppets on hands. That's not what this is. I mean, you see the actors manipulating with their arms, not unlike what you saw with Julie Taymor doing in The Lion King or even Avenue Q, where the actors on stage are as much a part of it. It's all a very seamless but not gimmicky piece of theater.
So museum world, we don't have a lot of time. So I cannot tell a lie. Last night you had a package on Greater Boston. And this is the part where I can't tell a lie. When I heard what it was about, I said, this is going to totally put me to sleep. I mean, it's not because of you. I just had no interest. I'm trying to be honest. The subject matter. I love the thing. Right. And I'm actually thinking of going. This is, what is it called? The Museum of Russian Icons?
Yes.
First of all, I obviously didn't know it existed. I haven't been there
a lot.
I thought
this was on your TV show.
It was last TV night, show? I'm saying.
Okay.
I'm saying.
Okay.
But
your TV show.
It'll be on my, I gave it up a couple nights soon.
I heard that.
First.
I heard you were begged. So in any case, tell us about this place.
Well, the reason I wanted people to see it is because it's very holiday oriented. But the Museum of Russian Icons is as they say, its founder collected a huge number of Russian icons. It's a pretty staggering collection, but they have special exhibitions. And the latest is Corn Cobs to Cosmonauts, Redefining the Holidays During the Soviet Era. It's really kind of a fascinating little story that, of course, once the Soviet Union took hold, the Soviets didn't want any religion trappings of after the revolution of what came before because it was too bourgeois. However, Stalin recognized that there was a morale problem in the USSR. So he said, well, we can reintroduce the holidays. So essentially what they did is they reintroduced Christmas but didn't call it that. They bumped it down the calendar a few days to New Year's and called it a New Year celebration. So you have ornaments and you have trees.
They're really pretty
and
great.
And you have stories. But instead of Santa Claus, you have Lenin bringing presents to children or Grandfather Frost. The ornaments are all propaganda. There was Khrushchev's corn campaign. So you have lots of agriculture, food being put on the Christmas tree. And then, of course, we have the space race. So the trees are filled with lots of Sputnik-related paraphernalia.
Gosh.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah, the other museum we had was the Peabody Essex things, which we love, you know. But it's open till February. Can we hold
we can
that
talk
for?
About that
yeah,
later.
Because
yep.
Before you go away, a lot of us who don't actually go to movies or were sort of Netflixed up or on demand see more movies probably in the next 10 days than they see the whole rest of the year. Are there two or three that you've seen this year? And we'll do more of this in January. That really knocked your socks off, so that you'd urge people to try to go to or watch at home.
And I have a few.
Oh, good.
Because it's changing so quickly now that you can watch some of these at home, starting with Roma, the Alfonso Cuarón piece, black and white, looking at his childhood growing up in Mexico City in the 1970s. Just absolutely beautiful. You'll be mesmerized by the camera work, by the acting. This is going to be a huge Oscar contender. I think a movie that I just saw that is now available for rent on Google and Amazon is Eighth Grade. Jim, I think you may have spoken to the director.
Who's the director?
Bo Burnham.
Of course we did.
I remembered him being in
the movie. Of course we did, yeah.
That's supposed to be a great movie.
I finally just watched it a few nights ago, and I was so struck. It's really about this little girl in the eighth grade, and it just took me right back to eighth grade. It reminds you about all of what you're feeling, you know, in navigating and negotiating your way through school. And I thought, how did he do this? He got in the head of this girl. But that's a terrific movie.
It's the biggest argument ever against middle schools and junior high schools. You should go K through 8. Then you don't have that traumatic eighth grade year.
You know, we were talking about that when I was filling in with you the other day. But I disagree because some of the oldest friends I have all came from middle school.
Really?
Yep. Yeah, when we get reshuffled.
Okay, reshuffled.
By the way, he's really a talented guy, I should say. I was really impressed by him. Go ahead,
A couple more. The Favorite, we talked about it here.
Yeah, yep. You liked it.
I've
heard very passionate pros and passionate cons.
No, the con people, I don't understand what they're talking about.
Tom Fiedler is one of the con people, right? Oh, you see, Tom Fiedler wrote a letter.
Yes.
Tom Fiedler, who's portrayed not terribly
well.
No,
that's the front runner.
That's the front runner.
I'm sorry.
This
I thought you said
frontrunner. Your lady, Olivia Colman.
Oh,
Court of Queen Anne.
What have you heard bad about this? I hear the kids Olivia Colman are unbelievable.
A couple of Christmas parties, people said they thought it was terrible.
Really?
Yeah, they didn't like it at all.
My two words for it are demented and delicious.
Demented and delicious. I hope Mary Poppins is good.
I do too. I haven't seen that.
No. So one more.
One more. Another one I just finally saw, and I think we all need to see it, is Won't You Be My Neighbor, the Fred Rogers documentary.
Mm-hmm. Oh!
If you missed it this summer, you can see
it now. Is
that on TV? You can rent it, or it's probably on the streaming services too. But it's like just wrapping yourself in an Afghan for an hour and a half.
Oh, wow. I'm dying to see it. I don't know why I didn't see it. Well, because I don't usually go out to the theaters. That's a great list. Thank you, Jared DeBon. Are you working this? Is there a show this Friday or what?
Yes, we have you if you missed it on your show last night, you can see Corn Cobs to Cosmonauts.
It'll be even better on Friday nights. Go ahead. What else?
This is our holiday special, by the way. We also have Brian O'Donovan talking about Christmas Celtic Sojourn and showing a lot of his show.
I'm so excited. I'm seeing it this weekend.
I'm seeing it too.
And we have a performance from What the Dickens, a tap performance by the Cambridge Youth Dance Program.
Wow.
Well, I was right.
We went all out this year.
You really did?
We did. We've never done this before in open studio.
That's good. It's a festive time
of
year.
We'll be watching.
Jared Bowen is WGBH executive arts editor, host of the TV series Open Studio, co-host whenever Jim is out or I am out. You can catch Open Studios Friday nights, 8:30, right here at WGBH. Thank you very much, Jared.
Bye, Jared. Nice to see you.
Coming up, we're going to talk about the Affordable Care Act and what the latest court ruling involving that act means for health care. MIT economist John Gruber joins us for that. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And last week, as you know, a federal judge invalidated Obamacare, ruling it to be unconstitutional. If this case reaches the Supreme Court, most think it will, and the justices end up supporting the ruling, MIT economist John Gruber says the consequences could be dire. He, of course, was instrumental in creating the Affordable Care Act, which has survived a prior Supreme Court ruling in 2012, subsequent attempts by the GOP to repeal and replace it. John Gruber is the Ford Professor of Economics at MIT and a BPR contributor. Hello, John Gruber.
Good to be here.
Okay, Jonathan Gruber, let's start right at the beginning. What is the what's this decision? What did the judge rule?
So here was his logic. His logic was that the Affordable Care Act as constructed had at its center the individual mandate, the requirement that people buy health insurance, which we've discussed before was an important part of the underlying structure of Romney Care than the Affordable Care Act. As part of the Trump tax reform in the end of 2017, the Republicans removed the individual mandate penalty. They didn't actually get rid of the mandate. They set the penalty to zero. Now, the judge could have then issued a decision saying, well, since the penalty is zero, the mandate should go away. That would have been like an obscure little decision. But he went further than that. He said, well, if the mandate goes away, the whole law has to go away. And therefore, the entire Obamacare, soup to nuts, has to be gone because the mandate's gone. He relied on something called the notion of severability, the notion that the mandate is
lack of severability. Yeah.
The mandate is not severable from the law. And here's why pretty much everyone thinks he's wrong. In fact, I've yet to find someone who thinks he's right, including the people who argued against Obamacare before the Supreme Court in 2012 say he's wrong. Okay, and the reason he's wrong is because Congress had the chance to repeal Obamacare and did not. Instead, they repealed the tax penalty. So Congress has spoken. Congress has said Obamacare can survive without the tax penalty. They've spoken through their votes, which is the way they speak, by voting to continue to keep Obamacare in place and voting to remove the tax penalty. So what this judge is basically saying is Congress has spoken, and yet I'm not going to respect the voice of Congress. I'm going to decide that, due to my judgment, they're not severable, that I'm going to turn this out. It's really, in some sense, if you want to define judicial activism, it's the very definition of judicial activism.
So, you know, one of the things that I have not understood about this, and we're going to step back in a minute and talk about how the law without a mandate has done since the Republicans did remove the penalty, is everybody's talking about this ultimately going to the Supreme Court and then guessing what does it mean. You know, Roberts ultimately saying the individual mandate. He ruled the whole thing constitutional, essentially doing a dance and calling it a tax. But obviously there's Kavanaugh now on the Supreme Court replacing Kennedy. Before it gets to the Supreme Court, what is the impact of this ruling? I mean, if it isn't stayed by an appellate court or stayed by a justice.
No. The impact of the ruling is nothing.
Zero.
The earliest this ruling could matter is spring 2020.
Why?
Because the judge ruled that it wouldn't take an
effect. Oh, I didn't know that. He did in his own rule. To give it time for there to be an appeal?
Yeah, so the judge said that it wouldn't take effect yet. So it has to go to the appeals court, and it's not at all a given they'll approve his decision. Most people think they will, but it's far from done. And the Supreme Court, where most people think since really Kennedy voted against the Affordable Care Act, so replacing Kennedy with Kavanaugh.
That's a good point.
So really, there's sort of no logical case for John Roberts to support it last time, not support it this time. But, you know, look, the last case was crazy. Okay, this case is super crazy. We forget how crazy the last case was. Remember, for the 2012 case, 18 out of 20 constitutional scholars said, of course, the mandate's constitutional. And the Supreme Court disagreed. So, you know, I don't think we can count on this being okay.
So how is the law done without a mandate? One of the things we learned from the likes of you, as one of the architects and others, that if you don't require healthy people who don't need much health care, in other words, they're cheaper,
right,
to buy into a system to help subsidize people who are sicker, and then ultimately those healthy people will benefit when they're sicker, when they're older, or when something befalls them, it's going to be a real serious problem. But the thing is not imploded, and so how do you grade it? How's it doing? And why, if it's not imploding, why isn't it imploding?
So this is this other empirical argument against the lack of severability, which was you run the experiment and the law's okay. So so if the judge was right and it was not severable, then the law should have collapsed this year because we don't have a mandate this year. What's happened? Well, to be honest, it's a bit on the egg of the face of people like myself who thought the mandate was maybe more central than it was. And I think what we missed, first of all, based on the experience of Massachusetts, where the mandate was, I think, a more central piece of the law, but it was never really accepted at the national level. It was never really as effective. I think what we missed was the Medicaid expansions, which bring people into free public health insurance, don't really depend on the mandate, and that's the majority of the coverage.
Yeah, that's a great point.
The other point, and this is critical, you know, it's actually one of the things we fought for when the law is being crafted that turned to be critical, is the way the tax credits are designed. It's a kind of wonky detail that ends up mattering. The way these exchanges are designed is you get a tax credit. And the way the tax credit works is you pay a fixed percent of your income. So if you are today someone at 200% of poverty, you pay maybe 6 or 7% of your income, no matter what the premium is. So if the healthy people leave and the premium skyrockets, that doesn't affect you. You who are in, who are subsidized, pay the same. You pay 7% of your income no matter what. So that sort of builds in an automatic population. It's sort of insurance against the death spiral. Because there's people in this exchange no matter how high the premiums go. And so while the mandate has – removing the mandate, I think, has significantly increased premiums and probably lowered coverage some, both through Medicaid and the sort of shock absorber of these income-based subsidies, it's turned out that the law can survive, albeit in weakened form.
You know, before we get back to the law, I'm just curious. Do we know anything about this judge? Is he an outlier? Is he someone that's been overturned a lot? Does he have some – political thing
he's
going
a conservative
on?
Judge.
I mean, certainly you asked the right question, Marjorie, which has been overturned a lot. What I do know is that many conservative groups, when they want to bring cases like this, bring them to this judge.
Okay.
So he's known as the guy to bring him to. But although you asked the relevant question, it only matters if he ends up being overturned.
Yes.
And I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. And I wonder what you think the politics of this are, too, because we just had an election, and one of the big issues with Democrats and also with Republicans kind of did a 180. Not all of them, that's true, but a lot of them did, saying that we're going to protect your pre-existing conditions. We're going to protect your pre-existing conditions because people were very upset naturally about the pre-existing conditions. And it's also very hard to take away a mandate that once you've given that mandate out, whether it's to people in Medicaid or to just middle class people whose kids are kind of, you know, sitting on the couch after they get out of high school and college, they want to get them insurance and they want to get it without having to spend any money because they put them under their own policy. The politics of this seems to me to be very dicey.
So basically, I think that, you've got to. I guess your thing went on for a while, Marjorie. What exactly is the question?
What are the politics of this?
You're talking
about taking away a mandate.
Yeah. No, the politics, look, I mean, and the perfect case in point about the politics is Josh Hawley, who just won the election in Missouri
beating
who was part of the lawsuit, yet ran on protecting pre-existing conditions. Look, people are starting to realize how much this law does. So if you strike this law, that means the millions of people who have Medicaid, nothing to do with the mandate. Millions of people have Medicaid lose it. People on their parents' policies up to age 26, gone. The fact that now when you buy health insurance, we cap how much you pay out of pocket, gone. The fact that we've banned sham insurance policies, gone. Okay, this is a very broad-reaching law that I think the politics, people, when they realize what it's done, it's become more popular. So I think, you know, the way I'm thinking about this decision is there's a large chance that it's a small good thing for the Democrats and a small chance it's a disaster for the country. The large chance is it gets turned out by the Supreme Court and it ends up being something Democrats can run on. But there's a small chance it gets passed by the Supreme Court, and this and we have a huge problem with our healthcare system.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about what does happen if it's lost at the Supreme Court. But I want to talk about this interim period. I'm embarrassed to say I didn't know the judge had imposed the stay on his own decision. But during that year plus, because we're only a week away from 2019, what are the major stakeholders, forget individuals who are anxious all the time, understandably, who are dependent upon laws like this, what do health insurance and providers do? Because the assumption, I mean, one thing they hate, like all big businesses do, is uncertainty. Even if they don't like the thing, if it's certain, they can figure out how to work with it. What do they do in the intervening period since they have to have a plan B? Because as you suggest, the Supreme Court is unpredictable. Obviously, what do they do to prepare for a totally changing landscape?
Look, this is a very important point, Jim, which is before 2017, if you look at 2016, we had a situation where the exchanges and the insurance system was basically coming together. The ACA was working. Premiums had gone up, but they were projected to stabilize. And then basically what Trump and the Republicans did was inject a huge amount of uncertainty in the system. What did that result in? That resulted in a big spike in premiums and people not signing up. This is yet another dose of uncertainty. Now, is it going to be deadly? No. I think most people think the Supreme Court will turn this down. I think most parties will behave as if the ACA is going to stay around. But once again, it's more uncertainty. It's sort of, yet again, this law has had to fight so far uphill to get a foothold that it's sort of amazing succeeded as much as it has. Because at every turn, there's people trying to inject uncertainty into the law.
Well, speaking of uncertainty, one other thing that I assume could inject uncertainty, and I'm not weighing in pro or con, is it appears that the vast majority of serious candidates for the presidency on the Democratic side are going to campaign on a single-payer platform. And when the front-runners, or at least some of the front-runners, are single-payer types, and by the way, a lot of the new young congresspeople are single-payer types who may not have the numbers, but they surely have the voice and the willingness to use it. What does that do to the even if you love single, if one loves single payer or Medicare for all, whatever you want to call it, what does that do?
I mean, Ezra Klein, who's probably my favorite blogger of all, wrote that you know this decision is sort of the birth of single payer. You know that basically, I forget how he put it. He put it beautifully, of course.
Because they say this might disappear, now's the time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, I'm not as confident as he is. First of all, I think I've talked on this show before about the problem single payer faces, about the fact that 160 million Americans have employer-sponsored insurance. They don't want to give it up. The fact that you'd have to raise taxes enormously. The fact the insurance industry would lobby. But there's another – even if you don't want to believe this reason, there's another fundamental barrier, which is you cannot do single payer without 60 votes in the Senate. I mean, you just can't do it. You needed 60 to get Obamacare. Obamacare was way less aggressive than single payer would be. I don't see any way in the foreseeable future – in the next 50 years, the Democrats have 60 seats in the Senate. So basically, I just think single payer, it's a good aspiration. The principles that everyone should have health insurance are critical. They're getting more critical. The principles that we need to bring healthcare costs down are critical. I think the notion that we're going to get through single payer, I still don't see politically how we get there.
So I want to talk one more thing about the potential impact of a loss down the line, not to create anxiety in people around Christmas, but considering that it is possible. Many people labor under what I guess when you obviously were involved in Romney Care too. Well, don't worry if you're listening in Massachusetts, you're protected. But as there was a fine piece in the Globe the other day, and I'm embarrassed to say I don't remember who wrote it, talking about the subsidies that are federally funded that are so critical.
Priyanka,
that's absolutely right.
So explain what the demise of Obama, the Affordable Care Act, would mean for the provision of universal health care under Massachusetts law.
You can think of what Massachusetts did as sort of saying, we're going to put in Obamacare first, and we're going to put our own money in to show it works. And then when the feds came in, the feds said, you did a great job, Massachusetts. Now we'll pick up those costs you were paying. Mm-hmm. So if Obamacare goes away, that basically Massachusetts suddenly has to pick up hundreds of millions of dollars of new spending that the feds had absorbed from it. And so we're going to face a choice. Do we want to continue to have the system we have, but suddenly have to raise several hundred million dollars, I don't know the exact number, $300 to $500 million more a year in taxes, or are we going to cut back our system? And that is going to be a real challenge for the state. So the problem is not a legal challenge for the state, it's a fiscal challenge for the state.
Well, again, it's it wasn't that long ago that the idea of anything even approaching Obamacare, even though, as we've talked about before, it was a Republican kind of idea, right, with incorporating the insurance companies and everything, was so...
The mandate was a Republican idea out of the Watch Call Institute.
People went crazy about that whole idea. Now, so quickly, people have become acclimated. Even if they don't know it's Obamacare, they know that they're getting health insurance.
It's more than you think, Marjorie. We talk all about the insurance aspects, the age 26, the cap. Also, it fundamentally changed the way providers are reimbursed. So, for example, what Obamacare did, which was very important, was put in a penalty for hospitals that churned patients and readmitted them a lot. That penalty has massively lowered readmissions, for saving Medicare billions of dollars. That goes away. It put in new rules to make doctor reimbursement more sensitive to the quality of the care doctors deliver. That goes away. It put in rules which said insurance companies couldn't make excessive rates of profit, the so-called loss ratio regulations. Those go away. It covered the donut hole in Medicare, prescription drugs. That goes away. So people don't realize this is a huge set of things that to think all that – think about it. You're going to say that because the tax penalty of the mandate went to zero, we can't have donut hole coverage for seniors anymore? It's really pretty crazy.
Well, you know, it's one of those things. You used to talk years ago when we started working together, Marjorie. You talked about the worst nightmare for pro-life Republicans was if Roe v. Wade was ever repealed. And the beauty of the repeal and replace thing is it's great to be able to talk about repeal and replace when you don't have the power to repeal or replace or the votes. The bad news is when you do have the votes to do it. And my sense is, as conservatives' constituents, you would know this far better than I, John Gruber, as the constituents of conservatives see that the Affordable Care Act they love to hate is critical to their family, whether it's that kid who's 24 or it's the mother with pre-existing or whatever the hell it is, that the base of support for this, even if it's a quiet base of support of Republican elected officials, which leads me to believe, we only have a minute left, is there – I know you're not a legal scholar. You're an economics guy and a healthcare guy. Is it possible this decision might create an incentive for a collaborative deal in Congress in the next 18 months that would circumvent the decision? And you know what I mean, or no?
No, there is I do not think there's any way you're going to get collaboration on the fundamental level you'd need. Maybe little things around the margin.
But not to the core.
But not the fundamental level you need. I think that basically – this is something, and I want to be clear to your listeners. It's not like if the judge turns it down, people say, well, then just pass it again. Okay? This was a nightmare getting it passed. Mm-hmm. It's not going to pass again. And the thing that I disagree with about this, people say, okay, now it's time for single payer, is just look at the arc of history. Every time we've tried to do healthcare reform, we've moved to the right. Okay? And Obamacare was the most conservative of the last six efforts to do universal health care in America. I don't know why we're going to suddenly circle all the way around to the left. It doesn't seem very likely to me.
John, thanks for the tutorial,
Gruber,
as always.
Thank you very much.
Really appreciate it.
John Gruber is the Ford Professor of Economics at MIT and a BPR contributor. He was instrumental in creating the Affordable Care Act. Thanks again, John. And thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. You can reach us 24/7 by way of our podcast. You can get it on iTunes or at the App Store. Tomorrow, Andrew Cabral, former sheriff of Suffolk County, is going to be with us. Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist, and Heather Goldstone, our biologist, scientist, Woods Hole, our crew.
I don't even know if she's a biologist, but whatever she is.
I don't know. She's an expert on science.
Yes.
Our crew, Chelsea Murray, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Tresky, Arjun Singh, our engineer, John the Claw Parker, who knows everything. Thank you very much. What's on TV, Jim?
I have three biologists on with me tonight. No, they're not, actually. I have Jennifer Braceras, a senior fellow with the Independent Women's Forum, Michael Curry, former president of the NAACP here. He's now the chair of the NAACP's Advocacy and Policy Committee nationally, and Martha Coakley, former attorney general. It's the Greater Boston Year in Review, from the Year of the Woman to the Year of Mueller to Trump's America First to young activists from Parkland and beyond. So we're going to look back at the whole year. It's actually been fun preparing for it because you forget because there's so much crap going on every single day now.
I know.
To be able to take a look back.
I love years in reviews.
Both frightening and emboldening in some ways.
Okay, Jim's Year in Review.
What's
Greater
Boston is not Jim's. It's
going to be
Greater Boston.
Tonight.
With three biologists who are excellent scientists, by the way. I am Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan. Thank you for tuning in. Have a great afternoon and hope to see you tomorrow.